Hello, and welcome to the DVD commentary for Battlestar Galactica, the miniseries. I'm Ronald D. Moore, the creator and writer, and I'm here with...
Michael Reimer, the director of the mini.
And David Icke, the executive producer of the mini.
And this is actually the first time I think the three of us have ever sat down and watched the entire miniseries from start to finish, although we sat in the editing room for hours ad nauseum.
And the retrospective, I'm sure, will be enjoyable. I just hope when we're all done with this, we all feel the same way about it as we did when we started.
Well, we're drinking, so that helps.
That's true.
Let me tell you a little bit of the background just on this opening sequence that you're watching play out. The whole idea here, as I approached the script, generally was there was a great deal of backstory to set up about human-Cylon relations and how I had sort of reconceived the Battlestar Galactica universe as opposed to the original Galactica in the late 1970s. And one of the key differences that I wanted to do was to say that in the current Galactica version, that it was not a time of war, it was a time of peace, as opposed to the original series, and that certain things were very important that the audience know, namely that mankind had created the Cylons, and that a war had been fought, and now an armistice was declared, and it was a time of peace in the Galactica world. It was a great deal of information to try to cram into the open, and so as David and I were discussing various aspects of this, I came up with this idea of intercutting an officer walking into the space station and fading away, and each time you faded away, you'd read a title card that would bring you a little further along in the story, and you would come back to the space station, but then that officer would get older and older with each cut, and the idea would be that he was aging over a series of years, and you would then sort of like realize that, oh my God, this is happening a lot, it's boring, he just goes to the station time after time and nothing ever happens. And we actually shot that version, and then I think Michael decided, it was Michael's decision, I believe, when you were in the editing room, that didn't really work.
No, it worked, but it was incredibly long, and we were running an hour long, so it was just one of those tough decisions. To really make a play, we had to bite the bullet and just get on with the story.
And in truth, this was actually... it gave us an opportunity, even at the script stage before we were cutting it, to give the audience the backstory that Ron was just talking about. In the original script, the story begins with Starbuck jogging in a scene we're about to see. And in going over it, Ron and I felt like we needed the proverbial shark attack, something cataclysmic, something spooky to happen early on that then hangs above the audience like a dark cloud as they're waiting for the other shoe to drop. And so, to mix my metaphors. So, in many respects, because the scene was written later, much later in the process of the script development, it was able to take into account all the things we knew we wanted to set up for the audience to give them a context for the story.
So we did shoot a much longer sequence in which you see this guy aging, and this is the oldest age that he gets to.
And in the sequence that was cut, we had a picture of my son Jackson, which Michael cut out. I just want to point that out.
And this guy spent, you know, he was there at 3 a.m. getting all these prosthetics and makeup put on. It was shot. It took 2 days to shoot. It was extremely elaborate. And but we actually hired the same makeup artist who did the makeup work for the series, and she didn't kill me when she saw me.
We should also point out here that Tricia Helfer was someone who, as we were casting, it was a little bit unusual because she had come in really having not done anything much as an actor. She had done an episode of CSI, I think, in which she played a dead person, but otherwise her career was really as a model. And so it was ironic that we were able to get the network to allow us to give a role of this significance to such an unknown, and that by the end they were so enthralled with her performance that she basically became their marketing campaign.
And here we are putting the shark in the water.
It has begun.
what I liked about this sort of conceptually was that not only does she come and kill this man and destroy the entire station and tell you that there's something, you know, evil is afoot, but that also she comes back later in the story, and suddenly you're seeing another version of the blonde woman, and it raises the question in the audience's mind, well, who is that woman? And wait a minute, I just saw her destroyed, and I saw her killed, and how did all this come about?
There's also a beginning of the style, which actually Ron and David premeditated even before we shot a foot of film, which was this more realistic approach to science fiction. So you'll see fixed camera points of view, which went by quite early, a sort of Soviet-like era atmosphere to the armistice station, the way the camera actually gets knocked by the debris coming towards it. All those things are trying to create a more realistic doco-style approach.
Yeah, that was something that David and I discussed very early on, in fact, as early as the pitch stage for this project when we took it to the network in the studio. And it was something that I had sort of been cogitating on for a while. I had a background at Star Trek, The Next Generation, and Deep Space Nine, and a couple of the movies. And there's a very specific style to the way Star Trek is filmed and the way the spaceships are depicted and looked at. And I felt a certain artificiality to that approach and felt like it was distancing the audience from what was going on, and that you never really believed that these were real vessels in space doing real things. That what Lucas had started in the mid-70s in Star Wars, when he had sort of reconceptualized, you know, how spaceships move and pretended that they were all World War II fighters in dogfights, it gave it a great visceral sense and a lot of excitement, but it also sort of distanced the audience from the reality of any of it. So when we came to this project, one of the things that David and I went in and pitched was we're going to shoot this in a more documentary style, inside and out. And one of the things that we told Zoic, which was the visual effects house, and Gary Hutzel, who comes up on cue, of course, was to take the approach that all the spaceships are real vessels. All the Vipers are real fighters. You have to pretend that you went out there in space and actually shot them. That means you got a handheld camera on some guy's shoulder pointing out the window of some other ship, and it's hard to get focus, and you're losing them in the frame, and you got to figure out where the ship is. And there's no big sweeping 360 CGI created shots that sort of tell you intuitively as an audience that none of this is real and it's all being generated in a computer. It's sort of the antithesis. There's this theory in film about you never want to feel the camera. You want to be in a scene and you want to sort of the audience just sort of feel like they are there on some level. You never want to be aware of the camera. And this is sort of taking the opposite approach, where you're creating something that is fundamentally unreal. And the only way, in my opinion, you convince an audience it is real is by giving them a sort of underlying sense that there is a camera involved. There is somebody who had to actually go out and shoot this. And by providing them with that idea, they then buy into the visual aspect of what they're watching in a more fundamental way.
Ron and David's brief for the series is actually, let's take that even further, and I'm about to start cutting. There's actually some footage of one camera crew catching the other camera crew.
Oh, really?
I've actually seriously thought about putting some subliminal...
A little flash of them going
on. Oh, there's another camera crew.
I love that.
Yes, we should, to give a context, we've just been greenlit for a 13-episode, one-hour series launched by this miniseries, of which Michael Reimer is directing the first episode, so we're sort of still in the hangover process of that.
And before it's over, we should talk about the shot, which is a 4.5-minute steady cam shot, not really in the doco style, a slight anomaly in our general plan. We actually built the set, the CIC, the central control area, all these corridors and various bits and pieces in one stage, specifically so we could do that shot. It took all day to do it. Took about 8 takes.
Although not as many as I thought it would take.
Well, I think the Steadicam guy was falling apart by the end of it. So we were very relieved to get a good take where it all worked. Here is a set that we built. That's a set extension back there that he built in. It's enormously complex to do handheld moving mapping shots of mapping in backgrounds and so forth, so this is a new level of technology that we are innovating.
I haven't seen one of these in about 20 years.
If the commander will take a closer look
The design of the Viper is very close to the design of the original Viper in the original Galactica series. David and I, early in the process, had extensive discussions about how close does the show visually hue to the designs of the original. And one of the first things we said was, okay, the Vipers, we should make the Vipers look like the old Vipers. That's one of the key things of the old show and that people remember or are fond about and like the models of. So let's hang on to the old Vipers. The exterior of the Galactica should be roughly similar. There was some debate about how close it should be. I think I wanted it to be ultimately closer to the original than it turned out to be, but I think we all agree that it was roughly the same sort of alligator on skis sort of idea of what Galactica is.
Yeah, the network had a point of view on all of this, which was that the term that they had coined in the press was reimagining, which came to be a sort of popular catchphrase on the internet as people were assailing us for endeavoring to
and has now entered the common lexicon. Someone else is reimagining. Well, they've used that to describe the new Lost in Space.
Yeah,
reimagining.
Now it's reimagining everything.
Well, one of the aspects of reimagining was obviously.
Oh, and here's a clip from Happy Days,
with Henry Winkler. But one of the things that they wanted reimagined was the exterior of the Galactica, and so what you see in this is the exterior of Galactica is sort of a compromise between something more in the direction of what Ron and I originally had conceived as being evocative of the original and the network's feeling that we do a reimagined version of it, and it's sort of the happy medium, I guess.
I mean, this, for example, on a story level, this isn't a reimagining of an original Galactica sequence. In the original Galactica pilot, there is a card game that is played with the original Starbuck, played by Dirk Benedict, and he's the charming rapscallion rogue, eye for the ladies, and he smokes a cigar, and, you get the feeling like he's a good card player, and that he's always sort of either winning a lot, or he's always sort of losing a lot, and he's the rogue that you love to hate. As we approach the new Galactica and the new Starbuck, and we had decided to make Starbuck a woman, was one of the very, very earliest decisions. This scene was sort of mandatory. Okay, who is Starbuck in this version, and what's she like? And okay, she is going to be a bit of a rogue pilot, but in our version, a rogue means something more than it did back in the 70s. It means somebody who would actually take a shot at the XO, which is a very controversial sort of notion. There was endless discussions about it with the network, and it got a lot of flack on the internet from the fans. And it was one of the more controversial aspects of her character, but I felt, and David felt, and I think we all felt, that it was important early on to sort of lay down a marker and say, we are different. This is a different show. We're going in a different direction. The characters are more fundamentally flawed. The characters are deeper. The characters, will do things that, heroic leading characters in television drama don't typically do.
What's up? Okay, I'm fine.
There were several movies that were used early on as touchstones for what we wanted to do, and that list expanded when Michael came aboard. High on the list was Black Hawk Down, 2001, of course, and also as Michael got involved, the original Alien. And I think that this scene for me was sort of a nod to that camaraderie and the sort of R&R spirit that exists between people on ships and people who are forced to live together for long periods of time, and the sort of casualness and offhandedness in the behavior of people, and how something like a fight could break out, not because of any external issue or dramatic event, but just because people get on each other's nerves and they fight. And I really thought that was an idea that was captured incredibly well in that scene.
Also the handheld camera, the crushed blacks and the sort of highlights that blow out sort of remind you of newsreel footage, which are films like Saving Private Ryan and Black Hawk Down used extensively. And a lot of ad-libbing on the set, a lot of looseness where the actors are finding human bits of business to sort of flesh out this world.
And to that point, I mean, one of the things that really pleased and surprised me to some extent, when this was all being shot, I was not available. I was producing a show called Carnival for HBO in Los Angeles. So David was directly producing this up in Vancouver, and Michael was directing. And although we had had discussions and had, I'd had some limited input into pre-production, and then I got this box of dailies back one day. A large box of dailies arrived on my doorstep.
A huge box of dailies.
And I opened them and was so happy because one of the things that really happened on the stage was texture. That scene that we just watched, where Adama is taking the clothes out of the closet, and there's a sense of a disorderly, rumpled mess in the commander's office, and the way he interacts with Ty, and the whole nature of the relationship. Shirt being off. All that, none of that was in the script. All that just sort of came to life on the stage, which was what I was really hoping that this would do, which was to give a different life to science fiction on television.
And the person who most wants to do that is Edward James Olmos. In fact, yeah. In rehearsal, he decided that he wanted to start that scene sitting on the toilet, which we actually shot. We show him getting up off camera and zipping up his trousers.
I think I somehow missed those dailies.
And Ty waving.
And then without telling me, he directed Michael Hogan, Ty, to just quietly go up and shut the door behind him on one take. And we all looked at each other behind the monitor and sort of went, too much information.
I'm afraid. We should say, since we're talking about some of these actors, that whenever you're sitting down at the earliest stages of a project like this and you start talking about characters and talking about what kind of story you want to tell, as a matter of shorthand, you start plugging in actors and actresses' names so that you're able to quickly get a sense or a picture in your mind of the character that you're talking about. And one of the things that sort of was shocking about how this all came together was that in the shorthand that Ron and I used at the beginning, we actually said Mary McDonnell in talking about this character. And as we began looking at prototypes for Adama, certainly being huge fans of Blade Runner, Edward James Olmos's name came up early as well. And both of them were pie-in-the-sky names. We never really had any expectation that we'd get either of them. And it was just always sort of for our own shorthand so that we would know what we were talking about. And to be sitting here now looking at this with Edward James Olmos and Mary McDonnell is sort of surreal because it just never happens that way.
No, I felt very lucky to have those two people to work with. They taught me a lot and challenged me every day. Well, I guess we'll talk more about Mary's character, Laura, when she comes back. We should talk about this scene because mm-hmm. it caused quite a lot of controversy.
And it was a very, it was seen
very late edition.
Probably the last scene written, actually.
Yeah. I wrote this in L.A. when you guys were up here, as I recall.
Yeah, that's right. The obvious idea being, or maybe not so obvious being, we saw number six commit an act of destruction. Later on, we'll see how number six plays a role in the story. But it seemed like we needed some way of indicating to the audience that her presence held menace, and that whether by design or decree or by accident or by curiosity, there's something very, very dangerous about this woman.
And so as David and I were sitting and talking about what that could be, and we were talking about various things, she could kill this person, she could do that, we could see her doing something awful and evil, I kind of remember just talking and just saying, well, what if she kills a baby? Like, she's in a park and she sees this child in a stroller and she just snaps its neck, and David like went pale and then immediately said, I love it! And then we went this direction, and this was not actually structured in the script to be, this is actually, if you were watching this on the air, this was the act one break. This goes to commercial immediately after this. In the actual script, this laid out somewhat later in the process, and it was in editing, in post-production, that we decided that this was the best act one out. Because it sort of brings home the setup with six that you open the show on, and then sort of, you know, reminds you of what's going on. It really draws your attention to this blonde woman and this sort of, again, the shark in the water. Now, when this was aired, people flipped out. I mean, it was when they did the ratings. There's a rating chart that gives you the moment by moment rating, and like we lost a good chunk of the audience at that very moment. That then slowly came back, and so the network, in retrospect, was like, well, you know, we never should have done that. But actually, I think it was one of the best things that we did, and it really does, like, you know, it nails home the threat of this woman like nothing else does.
And to me, it's not a sort of contrived purient thing, because it gets down to the basics of number six's character and who she is, and you know, she is part of the race that wants to destroy us, but at the same time envies us, wants to be like us, is fascinated by mm-hmm. us. And we were always talking from the head of the network down about the correlation between the Cylons and Al-Qaeda, and trying to find ways to elaborate that allegory.
Now, I have to point out, coming up, show I produced a few years ago called American Gothic had a great scene in it that I loved, where Lucas Buck, the devil, punishes his concubine who's with another man by having her reach a fever that threatens to basically boil her alive. And I was thinking about this as Ron and I were talking about what we could do with number six and what sort of interesting things we might be able to show to, again, maintain her menace. And sort of in the category of why Ron is a great partner, I stepped out of the shower one morning and said to my wife, okay, I have an idea, but I don't think Ron will ever go for it. And the notion was that Baltar and number six are making love and that they're beginning to get more and more heated. And she's saying to him, I'm so hot, I'm so hot. And we come around and see that on her back, her spine, in sort of a nod to the red light of the original Galactica, is beginning to glow. And Ron looked at me, didn't break a smile, and I thought, oh, he just hates this. Now he thinks I've gone completely cheesy. And he said, okay.
I was like, well, that works. And my mind was going, what does that mean? But and I never, we have no explanation for this. There's no explanation.
It does violate some basic logic and
absolutely.
But at the same time, the whole idea that this number six character is the proverbial shark, and that her sexuality and her sexual power is directly related to the threat that she has against mankind is very important, because it's through sex that she is able to undermine and infiltrate the human race. And it is our great Achilles heel. It is our great weakness.
Right.
And, you know, particularly once we cast Trisha, who has that power, she doesn't work it as a person when you meet her, but she has that power that you watch her do what she does, and you go, well, if I were Baltar, I'd be hard-pressed not to do the same thing.
Right.
I mean, and that was one of the things that also, just the sexual component, the sexuality in the miniseries was, again, something that set it apart from the original and sets it apart overall from other science fiction. There was a sort of a reaction on the internet and among some fan circles that was, oh my God, it's a show, it's all about sex, there's all these characters having sex, oh my God. Well, if you look at science fiction in general, there's a lot of, like, cheesecake involved, generally. There's a lot of dressing up women in various dominatrix-type outfits. There's a lot of implied sexual innuendo. There's a lot of sort of naughty moments where you see, you know, you put Carrie Fisher in a harem slave girl outfit and chain her up, you know, in Return of the Jedi. Everybody's cool with that. On some level, the science fiction audience is comfortable with this sort of fetishism and objectification of women as sexual objects, but when you present in this context real sex, characters are having sex in this and are, you know, involved in relationships in this miniseries because that's what their characters are really involved with, it's somehow set off all these strange alarm bells. But in reality, there's nothing in this miniseries that is more shocking or more controversial than your average episode of NYPD Blue or ER.
It's just always been verboten in this genre.
Yeah.
Morning, sir. Chief Tyrrell. I'll be your crew chief while you're aboard.
Morning, Chief. Captain Leodom.
It's a real pleasure to meet you, sir. I'm sure you've heard this before. I'm a great admirer of your father's. Service is going to miss him when he retires.
Well, I'm sure someone will. Is your auto landing system down? I was hands-on for the whole approach.
It's all hands-on here, Captain. There are no auto landings in the Galactica. Commander Adama's orders.
Is that right?
It's a little bit of an artifact of the editing and the compression of the first hour, which in your script was much more elaborate. That some of these sex scenes got crunched together.
Are a little faster on top of each other.
For instance, there was a sequence that preceded this scene where you see Boomer nearly crashing her Raptor, which was a very fun, exciting visual effects sequence. It was funny, and you got to see the physics of space and made it feel more real. Now that's gone, so now we go straight into the next sequence where you lose the context that she just nearly died.
Yeah. And you're so coming back, you just saw Baltar and Six have sex, and now you're like right
which
in the
is, which wasn't all about originally sex. Where it was.
Yeah.
Now, Baltar is also, I mean, you were talking about the fate of humanity and the weakness of men, and as we get closer into Baltar's stuff, I think we can talk a little bit more about the fact that we really wanted to design a character who wasn't evil and who wasn't inherently malevolent, but someone who was just narcissistic and pathologically full of himself, and that becomes his undoing.
All right. Now, today's the main event. We have formation
demonstration. That's John Mann, who's an actor I've worked with on a part before, Haunted, and he's a wonderful actor. Also a bit of a rock star up in Vancouver, where we shot.
And is really great, and if we could find a way to bring his twin brother back.
We killed off so many good, good actors.
That's right.
Grace Parks, who's a regular on the series, who I think this is her first big job. And Jamie Bamber, who's playing Apollo, who I love what he did. He caused some controversy by playing the role with an edge of unlikability, ambivalence, complexity, which we're not used to seeing in the hero. So not everybody who watched the mini actually liked Apollo, which I actually thought was a big plus, but in the world of the mainstream, that might not be perceived that way. The same thing applies to Laura's character, to Mary's character, Laura. You know, she becomes president, but she's not always, you know, the strongest, most coherent leader. And as you were saying before, Baltar is a villain, but he's actually quite lovable in his own way.
Well, I think one of the things that really changed for me about the character of Baltar on the from the page to the screen was, on the page, what I liked about Baltar was the ambiguity of him, the not really a moral quality to him, although that's part of it. It was that he was always sort of blind to his own weaknesses. There was a great deal of arrogance. He was, you know, a scientist who had reached the top of his profession. He was good on camera. He lied to women. He was very slick. And then it all blows up in his face, and his first instinct is to call a lawyer. I liked all that on the page. What I didn't see coming, and which I think is really a delightful part, is how funny he is. James and Michael and everybody involved on the stage really suddenly made this character not just sort of despicable and weak and complicated, but also very funny and lovable at the same time, which I never really anticipated.
I have to go.
For those who are paying careful attention to the opening of this scene, the children playing what looks like a, you know, sword game with each other are actually wearing little Cylon masks and waving Cylon swords circa,
from the original Cylon,
yeah, circa 1978, yeah. Battlestar Galactica, so get your freeze frame button ready. But just fast forward past the strollers that you saw in the background earlier, because those do torture me every time I see them. Oh, God. I remember on the day just going, are we sure we shouldn't just have everyone carrying their children?
Well, that was it's part of a larger question. We decided not to do a lot of high-tech gizmo stuff to say, oh, this is a future world. Also quite controversial. Requires the audience to suspend disbelief another level in a way.
Well, yeah, in the original script, one of the things I loved, and it was a shame to have to lose when we needed to trim down the opening, was that the armistice officer, again, as Ron said, sort of bored by the inactivity of no Cylon showing up, takes out a snack, which includes an apple. And I thought it was a great visual way to communicate to the audience that this is a sister culture and that we're not going to, you know, have strange food and everything, you know, looking like a bad prop house science fiction version of what we have. But in fact, telephones look like telephones. People eat apples. The little girl later is going to refer to chicken pie. There are cues in this all throughout to tell you that on some level, this is a sister culture that in a distant galaxy may have originated from the same DNA as our own.
And Billy is wearing a suit and tie and speaking English.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and it's stripping away a lot of that, again, a part of the artifice of science fiction, which is, wow, oh my God, that's a chair! What a strange, crazy chair in that world! And you're so busy sort of getting fascinated with all those sorts of details that you're sort of more distant from the drama involved and more distant from the characters. And at the nature of this particular episode, this particular story, you know, is the end of the world. And watching the end of the world take place in the post 9/11 world has a very different resonance, I think, to the audience than the audience that watched the original Galactica in 1978. We've all gone through a day, an event, a trauma where you're just going about your life and suddenly everything changes and people are dead and just this bolt from the blue attack happens. And it felt right that when we were doing this miniseries that we played as truthfully as we can and that we not sort of gloss it up with, you know, space clothes and space hair and make these people strange, wacky aliens who are going through something.
And so much of it comes down to performance, and, you know, you have to give Michael the nod here for finding a way to, on every level, not just with our leads, but many characters who we've now brought back to be series regulars in the series who were Michael's selections up in Vancouver. Paul, the actor playing Billy...
Campbell is a brilliant.
Candace,
who you just saw, the black girl.
Who's playing Dwella. The guy who looks like Kevin Spacey, who we just saw, who's playing the
Matthew
character.
Matthew Bennett, who does a great job as the PR person. It was great.
Yeah, we really got lucky with even the minor roles and the supporting roles. And again, it was all sort of contributing to this central idea of reality and always going back to that notion of at every level, from the way it's shot to the CG, the computer graphics, to the wardrobe and so on and so forth, that the way the dialogue is read, the way it's written, obviously, but the way it's read and the way the characters interact with each other is very naturalistic. It's not theatrical. It's not done in a vein that makes you, that calls your attention to it. It's the kind of conversation that you might hear every day.
We called it naturalistic science fiction,
exactly.
Taking the opera out of space opera.
Which we got away with because you write very coherent, I don't want to say theatrical, but the scenes are well-structured, they're tight, they're heightened.
Right.
There's a structure there that you can mess up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of wit, there's pithy, clever stuff. If it were really naturalistically written, it would be incredibly boring.
Right. Well, one of the first things you said to me was, okay, yeah, it's I understand what you're going for in the docu-style, and it's more naturalistic, but you pointed out quite correctly that the story itself is very traditional, that these are very traditional human emotions, that the characters go from A to B to C, and that you could really grab onto them.
There's father-son connections and deaths and mourning and things in the past that are much more compressed than you find on your average aircraft carrier.
This is the first day.
I love this scene. I love Baltar in this scene and Six and the fact, you know, how long has she been sitting there watching him very quietly?
Well, what's also significant about it is that this was the audition scene for Baltar and Six, and traditionally, by the time these poor actors who have had to read these audition scenes 5,000 times to get the roles actually show up on the day to do the scene, the scene's so stale, and they've said these words so many times that it usually ends up being the worst scene in the movie or a scene that you end up cutting. And I really thought that the staging of this and these two actors' ability to find a fresh way into these ideas is quite an achievement when you consider how many times they had to read this thing.
Mm. So this is Baltar's house on Caprica. Again, there's a lot of wood, natural fabric, you know, a lot of earthy texture. It's not high-tech chrome and glass. We just tried to make this as relatable as we could.
And one of the great things was, I mean, I don't know when you're viewing this, but as we're recording this, we are in the midst of producing the series. We're shooting episode 2 as we speak at this moment. And as David and I and Michael were approaching the series, there were things that really popped out to us in the miniseries that we wanted to do. And one of them was Baltar's house. Baltar's house was so interesting and so evocative and was such a great place that at an early stage I decided, let's keep going there. So invented this sort of in the series itself, Baltar continues to go to his house, his destroyed home on Caprica, to have conversations with Number Six as sort of a refuge in his mind to get away from the awfulness of life aboard Galactica.
A great idea.
A great idea. I mean, just viscerally, to be able to get out of the ship every week and go to this bucolic, idealized, sort of romanticized place where the sky is blue and there's a beautiful woman waiting for you is quite something.
Yeah, Baltar has the great bachelor pad. I mean, he has like the coolest bachelor pad that any of us ever wanted, you know, with the view and the blonde and the big TV. And
so just again, the beginning of the scene was very behavioral. You got a sense of the estrangement between father and son here.
Michael didn't want to use a shot.
Very naturalistic. That then leads into a more, I guess, traditional scene in a way, although we allow the actors a lot of freedom. I say we because normally the writer, particularly writer-producer, is much more precious about their words and the intention of their words being preserved. And
it obviously didn't hurt that Ron was otherwise preoccupied.
Yeah, right. but Ron, was when he did see it and when he was around, was extremely encouraging about letting us try to get to the truth of it.
The only time Ron ever called about dailies was to talk about how much he loved it. In fact, I don't think you ever took issue with any of the...
No, I mean, I was very pleased because at Star Trek there was a very ironclad rule that the actors were not allowed to change lines of dialogue ever at all unless they called up specifically on the day, talked to the writer and said, can I change this to that and there to there are? And on some level, that's a good thing because it sort of preserves the intent of the scene, and Trek was going after very stylized, you know, this is how Starfleet operates in the future, and they talk in a certain way. But at the same time, it also sort of stifles creativity on the set, and it's not allowing the actors and the directors to find the truth of the scene and to make it comfortable and work.
And in this scene being an example, not so much in the dialogue, but in the staging, you'll notice Eddie never, the character Adama, never turns to look at his son. I don't remember if that was something that found itself as you were directing the scene, Michael, or that was premeditated, but it was such an interesting choice because he literally never turns to look at him the entire time.
It was actually Eddie's idea to not look at his son. I like the idea in general because in films often actors are too busy making eye contact when in life we'll actually have whole conversations and never look at each other. It certainly spoke to Adama avoiding his responsibility and connecting with his son, the tough military man who gave up everything for his personal life. And it also just tends to change the weight of the scene and put it more into Adama's head, that his son is a voice in his head feeding his own guilt.
And as a character, you know, what I liked about Adama and his relationship with his son and the other people in his life was that typically when you play this kind of character in a science fiction series, the captain, yes, he gave up a wife and child and he's decided to have the sort of monastic existence as a captain, and oh, he pines secretly for the, you know, the home and hearth, but you never really buy it. You never really go, oh yeah, you know, Kirk would be much happier in his cabin and Picard would be much happier, you know, digging around in the dirt. You know that they were really meant to be captains. Well, with Adama, there's a real sense of loss. There's a real sense that this man made certain choices and he's lived with them, but there is a real cost. He has a difficult, estranged relationship with his son. He's divorced from his wife. She's getting remarried. He's not close to anybody. And he's at the end of his career, and he's on a ship that's about to be decommissioned and retired, and he's going off into the sunset. And that's an unusual thing for the leading character in one of these shows.
Particularly for a character who's preparing himself to disengage and to perhaps deal with some of these unresolved issues, to suddenly get called back to duty and called back to action in a way he never really was during any active part of his career. So it's a great dilemma to place your lead character in.
Just a plug about the costumes. Deborah Everton did a great job on the flight suits, but she put a lot of energy into designing costumes for Number Six that were sexy, otherworldly, somehow non-human. This one is a sort of, I guess, a riff on the spider motif. The first costume that number six came in was a see-through Chanel suit, which only, I guess, the more refined fashionistas would get.
I had nothing to do with
which would not be me.
You know.
Again, I like this writing very much. He finds out that he's responsible for, you know, betraying the human race. And immediately starts calculating the consequences to himself. Which in a way is a form of denial. He's not really actually processing that he could destroy the human race. But that he's going to get caught.
Well, I think the thing about Baltar that's so interesting is that it's more difficult with this quote-unquote villain to distance yourself from his point of view. He behaves, in some regard, the way many of us would in these circumstances.
Yeah, so we would panic.
So you can't say to yourself, I'm enjoying this villain from afar, or I hate this villain from afar. In some respects, the villain is us, and we're forced to relate to him.
When he finds his lawyer, though, I don't say to myself, what a reprehensible person. I go, how cute that he would think to phone his lawyer about the end of the world.
And it's something that I would do. You know, it's like you're looking for ways out. Okay, how do I get out of this? Yeah, I know millions are about to die, but I'm going to get caught, and I better call my attorney.
Which is how people behave. They're not.
Yeah.
It's like after September 11th, we were more shocked. It took so long to get over the shock of it. And what we worked very hard to do is not have people process things too quickly. The world's been destroyed, we're under attack, we'd better do something. Now, the military personnel, when it happens, go into autopilot like
that's what they're trained to do.
But the civilians are extremely disoriented for the longest time.
Yeah, you go around, you go, oh my God, how does this affect me? What does this mean? What am I supposed to be doing? And it's also just sort of, you know, he's a villain in the piece, but you typically have your villains in a weird way behave heroically in crisis moments. You know, usually the villain doesn't panic when a crisis happens. Usually the villain rises to the occasion in an evil way and does something, you know, I will get out of this circumstance. He doesn't call his attorney. You go, oh my God, I'm going to get caught. Oh, please help me, you know.
That's Michael Hogan, who plays Ty.
Another local actor who was...
Very talented.
Yeah, very talented, and someone who we were just real fortunate to get for that role.
Sometimes it's too high.
This, to me, was a really important beat in the life of the character, that Commander Adama, the military leader, on the eve of the destruction of his world, for personal reasons, in the middle of sort of a standard issue speech about patriotism and sacrifice and honor and things that, you know, we have heard many, many times in the culture, that, you know, people get up and on these formal occasions and they pay lip service to a lot of noble ideas. But Adama in this moment breaks, and because of what's going on with his son, it makes him take a hard look around at who they are. You know, why are we worth saving? Why do we deserve to survive? Who are we really? You know, we're putting all these men and women in harm's way, and we're spending a lot of money in defense, and we're doing all these things, and we're telling ourselves we're the noble creatures, children to the lords of Kobol. And look at us. We still, you know, this was a much longer speech in the script, and it went in, you know, it was a little too long, but, you know, the ideas are still there about, well, who are we as a people? Who are we as a species?
And the way it's shot here is really significant, because he's, again, suspended in space. You've got that sort of signature Eddie Olmos face, you know, which he calls his trademark, and, you know, he looks vulnerable. He looks alone. And it's a very effective scene, both in the way it's written and the way it's shot and the way Eddie reads it here.
I think you're particularly right about the resonance. I felt a lot of resonance reading it post-September 11th, that the immediate, you know, the 6 months after September 11th, there seemed to be a deepening of the American experience, where people would say hello to each other in public spaces, and suddenly we were focused on family and heroes and loss and bonding together. And then within 9 months, everyone was watching The Bachelorette and the worst sort of shallow garbage. And I said to myself at some point watching TV, at some level, was Al-Qaeda right about us? Are we that superficial?
Decadent that, yeah.
And decadent that we just go back, we sort of tap back into this this meaninglessness.
When one of your leaders says, when you're, when the top of the pyramids looks around and says, well, the response to 9/11 is to keep shopping, you know, when that's the noble sacrifice that you're asked to make.
Ask not what your country can
Are we worth saving?
Are we where you can shop?
You know, is this really right? And this show, I mean, this series began in that world, began with David and I talking about things that were happening today. And, you know, we wanted science, this particular piece of science fiction, to be relevant, to comment on humanity, to take a hard look at the culture and what was happening around us, and that it would have escapist tendencies in it and attributes, but that it wasn't purely escapist, that the show was ultimately about something, and it was about us, and it's about this point in time and what we're going through.
I can't die. When this body's destroyed, my memory, my consciousness will be transmitted to
now,
you.
Now, I really like the way this the scene is directed, because, again, sort of walking that line between pathetic Baltar, a villainous Baltar, and a relatable Baltar, I thought, I mean, this is a scene that is simultaneously horrifying and actually gets a couple of laughs every time I watch it in a group of people.
Yeah,
he shrieks as he sees the red lights, and it's a great balance, I think, of all those different ideas.
Well, I love the way she pushes him down to her, not to crotch level, but like a mother protecting a little infant.
Mm. This is a great moment with Eddie. I love the cluttered look of his quarters.
I'm sorry to disturb you, sir.
And this is essentially a riff on the alert from Pearl Harbor in 1941. When Pearl Harbor was attacked by the Japanese, a flash message went out to the fleet that just said, "Air raid Pearl Harbor, this is no drill."
Yeah, and that's what the end of the world will be like.
Yeah.
It'll be this banal...
It's over.
This gentleman, Alessandro, who plays Gaeta, is also very strong. And
Alessandro.
Did I say his name incorrect?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. My very good friend. I thought I said Alessandro. We call him AJ on this set.
AJ, yes.
This is my wife, Jenny. Thank you.
very, very talented actor. Makes all that techno stuff sound really...
Yeah,
weighty.
He's too good at that, because at Star Trek we would glom on to actors like that and say, hey, guess what? LeVar Burton says technobabble really good. Give him all of it. And then suddenly he's stuck saying all these preposterous lines because he can sell it.
Well, fortunately for us, the recent discovery we've made in episode one about AJ is that he's incredibly funny, and so as the series evolves, we're going to see Gaeta in more compromising positions.
We've mentioned Michael Hogan here playing Ty. I just want to also mention Aaron Douglas, who plays Chief Tyrrell, the guy in the orange maintenance suit, who on paper had a much smaller role in the script Ron would write. And then Tyrrell sorts out the deck, and we're left there going, okay.
what is that?
Well, let's figure it out. And so I threw Aaron the ball, and he ran with it, and he ad-libbed and created business, and sort of my favorite sort of actor who never stops acting. You know, until I actually never call cut. I let him keep going, and Eddie's one of these guys as well. He'll go on to the next scene. He'll get on with the business of running the ship. And it shows a real commitment, imaginatively.
Well, Aaron Douglas is, I keep calling him Little Duval, which is probably not a good thing, considering we haven't negotiated his series option for year two yet. But he does, like Duval, never stop acting, and he's a great listener and a great ad-libber.
How, why, doesn't really matter now. What does matter is that as of this moment...
So we were using a lot of Aaron's beats just to add a human face to a lot of what was happening.
You're ready for this.
It's a very human show. I mean, that was also one of the hallmarks that we kept saying, was this is about human beings, make them real people. You know, all these little reaction shots of people reacting as they really would. They're not playing false heroics. They're not giving the artificial never say die kind of beat, and they're not milking the pathos of it either. They're just reacting like human beings would react.
Like, that's Kick Some Silent Ass is ad-lib.
It's totally him, yeah.
Not my style at all. Too American gung-ho.
Yeah, but I was at the monitor jumping up and down.
David was loving that. And he was right, because that's what military people do. They jack themselves up, and they want to kick ass. And it made complete sense.
And you can see that the crew didn't, like, burst into spontaneous, like, cheers. They sort of, like, yeah, okay, let's go kick some silent ass, he said,
right.
You know?
Well, in the editing, we took the edge off it by just having him turn to himself and say, I hope this is for real.
Which is from a different scene, yeah.
So you go, oh, it's an act. Yeah. He's putting on the chief face.
Right.
Something we haven't talked about yet is the idea of less sound in space.
We started with no sound in space.
We weren't gutsy enough to do no sound.
Yeah, no sound was a little too... I mean, that was where we started, was let's play it real, no sound in space. And then it just became too much.
It became a distraction, really. And partly because... you know, our collective understanding of these types of stories is such that we come to expect sound in space, and also partly because you were cutting from interiors to exteriors, it was just so arrhythmic, you couldn't get into a scene because you're constantly being nagged by this, you know, sound discrepancy.
Relative to another Star Wars type film, the exteriors are much more realistic in that it's muffled as if we're hearing it.
Yes.
Through
well, I was very happy with what Aniflex did here, because this was something I was clinging to from my memory of watching Star Wars for the first time. Was I loved how the radio voices sounded in the Rebellion headquarters when they were attacking the Death Star. It just sounded really authentically dirty and garbled, and like these were, you know, Dixie cups and string basically tied together to get these sounds. And I really thought Aniflex, the sound house, did a great job sort of manufacturing that idea again, which I really hadn't heard since the original Star Wars, and it's a much messier, dirtier way of hearing pilot chatter and radio voices.
It's a quarter of the fleet.
I need pilots and I need fighters.
Here's another scene where Eddie's not making eye contact.
Wait, I'm beginning to see a trend.
I seem to remember an entire squadron of fighters down on the starboard.
No, he does, and it's a different sort of scene, obviously.
Well, yeah, because the character is much closer to her than he is to his own son, which is actually an idea we're exploring a lot in the series.
It sort of conjures up the feeling of a close relationship, that if you don't have to eyeball someone all the time, you know him better.
Exactly. I point out that insert shot of the museum velvet rope hitting the ground was Peter Dashkowitz's call to remind us that we were in the museum section of the ship. I believe as we were shooting this, we were behind schedule and losing the day, and so...
All Aaron's stuff there was mostly, again, ad-libbed. I'd like to mention Candace again, who, along with AJ there, really, if you'll notice, they run the entire ship, dashing around.
And of course,
the
trimmed corners of the paper, which, if you'll pay close attention... It's a telltale sign you're in the world of Galactica.
Yeah, that's our one nod to its space. See, look at the paper.
We tweaked every odd thing, yeah.
The prop guys were spent weeks trimming corners off every piece of paper and every book.
So you'll hear there's less sound in space, the aerodynamics or the space dynamics, the way the ships move, they don't...
Yeah, they're not really just... We're playing them not as atmospheric fighter craft. I mean, these are space vessels. Yeah. There's no reason why they can't go up and down and sideways and backwards, and it's all governed by the laws of inertia.
Originally, we had a sequence where we see one of these Vipers go down into an atmosphere and then the flaps kick in and we suddenly understand, oh, this is why they're pointy and long at all.
Mm-hmm.
Or why they have wings at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, why they even have wings.
And we didn't have the time or the money to finish that. I gather you guys are going to use it in this series.
Yeah, we're going to...
Episode 4.
Great.
This is a great Richard Gibbs moment, our composer. This is a sequence that you're accustomed to seeing played against... big orchestral music or sort of a bombastic score, and you hear a very sparse percussive drum beat that grows in intensity as the scene evolves, and it's another way in which I think we're trying to move away from the trappings of the genre.
Right. It's also the reveal of the new Cylon Raiders for the first time. In the original series, the Cylon Raiders were essentially flying wings in sort of a disc shape, and they were, I never felt they photographed very well from any particular angle and didn't look very sexy at all. So I knew that we wanted to completely change that idea, but I don't remember, I wasn't really involved as you guys evolved the Batwing. I think it was...
We said we wanted to, I was really into the idea that these things weren't Cylon flying craft, that they were Cylon themselves. It's sort of a biped mechanistic Cylon that had been squashed with an anvil and made into a flying craft, and so that's where we were able to...
I love that. I love that, this is
a lot of people's favorite
bumps
shot.
Into it.
But it, when we saw that reveal of the oscillating red light, as we talked about at the script stage, it was a way of nodding to the original show and maintaining one of the icons of the original, but doing it in a completely new way.
And that shot. Look at that shot.
That's great.
Well, you're expecting a gung-ho traditional dogfight,
mm-hmm.
and what you get... is a slaughter. It's this turkey shoot where these poor pilots are rendered helpless and just have to face their death and destruction. And, you know, again, thank God for John Mann for doing such a great job right here selling that. This, the frustration and helplessness as you're about to die.
It's also great, too, because usually there's this sort of odd, you know, cliche or tradition, whichever way you want to look at it, that the heroes are always outnumbered by the bad guys. It's always 10 times as many bad guys as there are heroes, and that's, if we're ever defeated, it's only because there were more of them than there were of us. And this time, it's completely the opposite. There's only 2 Cylon fighters, and they completely clean our clocks.
It's also a very well-edited scene. Danny did a remarkable job with that sequence.
Danny Cooper?
Our illustrious editor.
Laura's cancer was also a very early idea in the, at the script stage. I thought there was something interesting, not only about this woman who is, you know, 42nd or 43rd in line of succession to the presidency, who, on the day the world ends, becomes the president. That alone I thought was an interesting notion, but that she also has this built-in sense of mortality on the day that everyone else dies.
And that it's a disease that we all know and recognize, again, a nod to it being
very
a sister culture.
Yeah. Oh, this is something out of real life that I understand.
Yeah. Cancer being sort of a recognizable Earth problem, something the audience can relate to, was where I wanted to go, as opposed to giving her some made-up sounding, you know, bizarro exotic disease that doesn't matter to anybody. When you say somebody has cancer, it means something. It brings an emotional response from the audience. It grounds you in the reality of it. You've suddenly put yourself into Laura's predicament. In the same way, although it's a different issue, it's the same reason why I chose to say that the Cylons attacked Caprica and the other colonies with nuclear weapons, as opposed to photon torpedoes or some made-up thing, because you say that nukes are going off, it scares me. It scares the audience. It's a real thing. It's a terrifying weapon. You know what that is, and it chills you on some level when a nuke goes off. You say that photon torpedoes or, you know, electroplasmic bombs are going off, it's just kind of made-up stuff, and you kind of brush it off and say, oh, yeah, I'm sure they're scared about that.
Which is the same reason we didn't have laser beams and laser pellets. That these are
railguns,
tactile bits, chunks of metal with explosives in them hurling through vacuums, you know, piercing the side of the ship as you're about to see. Although the whole thing about the nukes I find interesting, because we, you know, we did a lot of research watching atomic bombs, because we have some in this show, and it just struck me there was a quantum shift that happened maybe post-September 11th, where, starting with the sum of all fears, it became acceptable in a story to have a bomb detonated, even in a United States city, and you could still have a happy ending. It used to be in the 70s that
would have been it.
That would, well, yeah, that's the end game. That's
the end.
We lost.
Yeah.
If
the nuke goes off, it's a bad thing.
It's, well, it's not a bad thing, but we failed, the hero failed, the story's done. You know, James Bond, everyone.
Mm-hmm. It's all about averting that. Or you play it in a satire like Dr. Strangelove as sort of a joke, but you wouldn't have it.
It was still like a non-recoverable event. But you're right, Sum of All Fears, suddenly you've got Ben Affleck.
People living with atomic war, as we do in this show. And it just strikes me that the public tolerance for that has completely changed.
Mm-hmm.
Not for the better, either.
Now it's
we've become more accepting and more forgiving of that idea.
You can survive an atomic war.
Right.
Yeah.
Attack.
It's like, oh yeah, we can make it through that. That'll be okay.
it's interesting, the cockpit sequences we just saw were really, you know, they're staples of the genre, but in many respects, because of the way we've established you know, the documentary style, the handheld style, a unique rig was necessary to get angles and to be able to move around those cockpits in such a way that it felt as visceral as the rest of what we were shooting. And so while they tend to be sort of easy to accomplish in science fiction drama and sci-fi TV shows, they tend to be, for us, one of the harder things that we have to do.
I underestimated as a director how difficult and exhausting it is for an actor to sit in a helmet in a cockpit and believe that they're being shot at and that they're banking and turning and firing and that someone else they knew just got blown up. It takes an enormous feat of concentration on the actor's part and a lot of feeding from, you know, from the first assistant director to sell them on that concept. So here we have Mary's character, Laura, beginning to take the uncomfortable role of leadership. It comes much more naturally to Adama.
And again, as we were saying about Baltar, with these characters being us in some respect, I loved how this idea tapped into anyone who's had to, you know, not necessarily step up to a challenge, but just have to sort of behave as though they knew more than they did, or function in a role that where people are coming to them asking for help or asking for direction, and in many respects just having to make it up as you go. And in the later scene we'll see where she's sworn in, Michael and I had, because it was alluded to in the script as well, the shot of Lyndon Johnson being sworn in aboard Air Force One. And in fact, the shot sort of matches that, with the idea being suddenly out of nowhere, those you least expect to be in control are in control.
What I really like about Mary is the way you can see her figuring things out as a character. Laura is handed all of this, you know, unexpectedly. She sort of naturally decides she will tell people what to do on board the transport ship and sort of naturally assumes control. But it's not instinctual. You can watch her figuring out what the next answer is. You can see how she decides, you're going to do this and you're going to do that. And when she's presented with someone who challenges her here, you can kind of watch as she processes it.
Yeah.
You know, she figures it out. She decides how to handle this man.
We had a general strategy we got out of rehearsal, which was, let's try to make this as messy and ugly and awkward and difficult as we could every step of the way. And, you know, Mary was constantly pushing the boundaries where I'd have to pull her back, or maybe we'd have to choose a take where she was more in control and competent, because there's just the demand of the story that you want your heroes to be good at what they do. You want to invest in them emotionally. If they're complete losers, you can't go with them. But, you know, a lot of, you hear stories about movie stars always wanting themselves to portray characters that are smarter
and
more heroic. And the great thing about Mary and Eddie is they were constantly wanting to go the other way, to show the messy bits of who these people are. This is an interesting scene. You have Billy finding out his entire family was wiped out. Billy Paul, very talented actor, are sort of pushing him to be more emotional, and he never got there. And now I realize he played it so real. It's that level of shock and disconnect that makes that scene really work. And the fact that Mary doesn't give him a big hug, but sort of pats him lamely, like, I don't have time to deal with you right now, buddy. I'm moving on.
She's not perfect. She can't react perfectly to every moment. She does the best that she can.
Yeah.
This I always like too, and again, it's something that's on the page, but that moment right there where she contemplates the idea of surrendering to the Cylons, when if you're a member of the cabinet and you're contemplating, has anyone asked the president whether we should surrender or not, that should have a major thing. And you say that and you put it in a script, but nine times out of ten, it's not going to be there. But Mary, you felt the weight of that moment sort of land on her, like, oh my God, what am I about to say?
Knowing that on a normal day she would be shouted down and...
Yeah, she'd be at the far end of the table, and who cares what the Secretary of Education thinks.
This is the beginning of a sequence that was largely lifted due to running out of money, where Lee is bringing this heat seeker away from the colonial transport.
Yeah, originally this went onto an asteroid.
Yeah, this ultimately became a sequence which we are now going to resurrect for one of the episodes, in which Lee is able to get the missile into a nearby planetary atmosphere and basically have it chase him through canyons until he gets it into a position where he's able to destroy it.
Which I'm very gratified about, because it was a very cool pre-visualization sequence. And
oh yeah, we had the previous cut into the edit, and it was all going to happen. And
so I can excel at that stuff. And spaceships and fighters in daylight, there's something about that. That's particularly interesting.
Again, back to the iconography of nuclear war and imagery that we've seen, and that conjures up a very visceral response. You have these mushroom clouds on the horizon, which we go back to a couple of times through the sequence.
Again, strangely pastoral.
Yeah. Quiet, but to reinforce that paranoia and that fear. You know, these are images we've seen in newsreels and, you know, movies like The Day After, and they've always been these, you know, cautionary images and, you know, scenes from Hiroshima and the kinds of things that we can't ever allow to have happen. And to be able to use that imagery to create a reality on this planet that's very close to us and that has us relating to these characters and to their level of fear is, I think, incredibly effective. And Gary Hutzel did a remarkable job both on the research stage and then in the execution in helping us to understand how all this would really work. There's a lot of emphasis placed on the physical reality of this, how far away the bombs are going off, what the state of this particular meadow would be, the weather, the color of the sky, what these people may have seen, where they're running from.
And just the focus on the people trying to escape, not showing violence without consequence, but really, you know, just showing a microcosm of a much larger problem.
Well, I love the texture of all those people running. The guy that had his books,
the
guy in the crutches,
yeah.
Baltar's got his briefcase. I mean, it really is that sort of end of the world moment where you just grab something. Why is that guy running with a stack of books? But there's something so human about that.
Fine. My name's Aaron Dorrell. Met you before. Took some publicity photos.
So here you have Jamie still, you know, keeping that surly edge in Apollo. You can see it in his father. He's a bit brusque.
I can't tell you how glad I am to see you. Huh? Why is that?
Well, wonderful Matthew Bennett manipulating and pushing him.
Is something wrong with your pilot?
This was Ron's least favorite location.
inside a ferry.
Yeah, this is day two, right?
This works pretty well in the cut. When I saw the dailies on this, this was my one moment.
It'll never cut with the interior.
Yeah, I just didn't think this looked anything like this interior.
Right.
And I was afraid of how they were going to cut together. But actually, you know, nobody else ever had that reaction but me.
You know, it's my job here to also take the edge off of all of our self-congratulatory conversation and make sure I point out all the things that we don't like.
Yeah.
Any flaw.
Start the cargo transfer.
This scene makes that's a little bit of a confusing exchange when he comes in and says, you know, thanks, and the other guy says, thank her. It doesn't really make any sense in this particular version, because we did have to lift the other sequence when Apollo went off and was being chased by the Cylon missile and went very far away from Colonial One and was down in the canyon and then ran out of fuel and essentially got lost. There was another follow-up beat where Laura insisted that they go after and find Apollo, and it was a story point that she was the one that really rescued him.
I love this scene because you're expecting Apollo, the hero, to take charge and argue with this upstart school teacher.
Yeah.
I just love that.
Yeah,
he's so strong in that moment to allow her that power.
Yep.
Now, these guns were direct lift, or sort of indirect lift, I guess, of Blade Runner. And I remember when I saw that film, it was so refreshing because we had been kind of forced to swallow these laser blasters in all the Star Wars movies and their ripoffs. And in Blade Runner, you had these guns that fired these strange detonating projectiles that was just so refreshingly analog. And so we based the design of the pistol and also what it did, which later in the scene we'll see all too well on the Blade Runner weapons.
Again, the writing here, this whole idea that you can save 6 children, a couple of extra survivors, and the rest are going to perish in a nuclear cloud of radiation, is very dark and confronting and realistic.
It creates real jeopardy. It's real jeopardy. It's not TV jeopardy. It's most of these guys are going to die.
Yeah, these guys, the Tamo, who you just saw there playing Hilo, was so good, and we were so pleased with what he did. Again, another Canadian day player. We made a series deal with him, and he's now playing a pretty key role.
I can't believe you're giving that away.
No, they will have seen the show.
This has been on the air.
He has a key role in the series, and it's great when you can discover talent like that. This is Ron Blecker, the
He was our military assistant. He took the whole cast on a boot camp and scared the hell out of them. They came back so happy, though. They had such a good time. They had learned some sort of military bearing and decorum, but more importantly, they'd bonded in this way that I think reflects on the show. That there's this
that shot right there. That's one of my favorite shots.
Me too. Yeah, that's a great little Gary Hutzel moment.
All of this is I love this whole sequence because it makes me feel that the Galactica is a real, you know, aircraft carrier in space.
Hmm. Well,
trouble launching. There's problems.
An old one.
Yeah.
And this breakdown in particular, which also speaks to that, we had to fight to keep when the show was running long. And in fact, when this broadcast, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of, I believe, 6 minutes long, which is pretty unheard of. And I have to say, we were fortunate that the network was willing to give up whatever that number of minutes were of advertising to let us be this long. But this scene right here was in the crosshairs for quite some time because it's not specific to story. It's not necessarily critical. And yet, without it, you don't really get that sense that these things break down and that these pit crews literally have to work like mad to get them back up and going and all the risks associated with that.
Well, it's one of the conceits of Star Trek. Is that the Enterprise doesn't break down for no reason. I mean, the Enterprise, if it breaks down, it's because there's an alien in the engines or something. You know, something's wrong if there's a maintenance problem on the Enterprise. And that's fine. That's the way that show operates. In our world, we're making a point that this is a real world. Things just break down because things break down on Galactica.
And they just want to get these fighters out into space fighting.
Yeah.
However they can.
Just throw them out there. Get them out there somehow.
I so really love this, again, sort of reminiscent to me of the original Star Wars when the Resistance is listening to the battle over the radio and hearing this stuff that, you know, that they can't see and the frustration of that. And I liked how this all kind of came together. This is great stuff, too.
Katie's always so strong at making all those beats feel real.
Yeah.
Also, I want to, you know, compliment Nikki and Michael Eklund, who were the maintenance crew trying to make all that look real and doing a great job.
People are going to look at Nikki a whole different way after episode 3. A little breaking of style there, but that's okay.
A little breaking of style, but you know, spaceships flying backwards, you know, breaking the plane, not being afraid to show spaceships upside down.
Well, the whole idea of breaking style is if you have a style and you have a language that you've established with the audience that has some consistency and some continuity and a level of expectation to it, then you can break it and the audience will go with you. Sometimes these things can get sloppy and the style is there is no style, and so sort of anything goes, but you're not really involved. And in this case, I think when we do a snap zoom into a Cylon like that, which isn't a literal POV, it's such a breaking of style that the audience says, okay, this is significant.
I think another important thing we worked hard to do is show people dying. Real pilots getting blown up in a realistic way. Again, it's not just a video game where there's no consequence. These people are in a desperate place. They're prepared to do desperate things just to survive. There's no time to argue about the niceties and procedures.
And that third nuclear missile gets through just because she misses it. I mean, there's no other greater plot point. It's not some, you know,
the super secret silent device, she just misses it, and it goes past.
Now, of course, that was a much longer and more elaborate sequence once upon a time, but in truth, I mean, like all these things, you watch them, and I have a hard time remembering what it used to be, because it seems to work.
Well, I think you can sum it up easily by saying, in the director's cut, I delivered a show that had 600 visual effects, and we were...
budgeted for 150.
Yeah.
Ended up with 3 or something.
Yeah.
300?
Yeah, we ended up with 300.
So there's a lot of great stuff that went out the window, as there was a lot of great bits of drama that just didn't fit.
Well, I think one of the learning curves that Ron and I were behind when we set about to do this, and it's something that we're still actually correcting for in the series, is that in both of our experiences, TV producers, scripts tend to go fast. Ron would shoot Star Trek episodes in the 60-page length that would run, 45 minutes. Same with me on shows like American Gothic. Scripts are always long. Michael got this script, and it was much longer than the amount of minutes that ultimately the running time would be, and he tried warning us that the show was going to be a lot longer, and Ron and I kept saying, well, in our experience,
don't worry
60-page
about
scripts for a 45-minute episode, so don't worry. And truthfully, it's the naturalistic style where you hold a beat a minute longer, you're not cutting things in an MTV way, and it does tend to play much closer to a minute a page. And so, consequently, there's about an hour of story and character and visual effects and so forth on the cutting room floor.
This is one of my favorite scenes. Again, Aaron Douglas doing great work, Ty Olson, and Michael Hogan.
Michael Hogan's portrayal of Ty, to me, really helps set the show apart, too, because usually the number two man on these ships in science fiction is, the best friend of the captain, traditionally, or he's, just sort of a noble stoic guy like Riker was. He wasn't really stoic, but he was affable, but he was noble, and there was no besmirch of his honor. Everybody loves him. Spock was Kirk's best friend, and he had this austere kind of untouchable honor to him. Ty is a functional drunk and a deeply flawed man who, for reasons that the audience doesn't quite understand, is trusted by Adama and has been kept around by Adama for some reason. And then this crisis happens, and Ty is forced to step up and to actually do the hard decision that he himself isn't sure that he can make, and yet he does it. And I really enjoy the character, and I really enjoy watching Michael perform it.
And I think it answers the question, well, why would a commander of Adama's stature keep a guy like this around? And part of the answer to that is because he can make these kinds of hard decisions.
And I think, as again, not to talk too much about the series, but in the series you will see that he is on Galactica because he's a hard ass, and Adama is not. Ty is the guy that will walk around Galactica and yell at people, and that's not Adama.
Right.
This is Mrs. Eddy?
That is Eddie's wife.
Indeed.
Who did a great job, everyone here did a great job to the extent that it's often hardest to do the 1-2 lines. If you've got pages of dialogue, you can get into a rhythm, and it's easy. I've worked with lead actors who've done small parts and gone, God, that was hard. So here, you've got a large group of people. A lot of them aren't even allowed to speak. And they're all acting their hearts out, doing a great job creating the reality of these people in this predicament.
This lady has ticket number 47. This lady here.
Could you come up here, please?
Yeah, please.
I've always loved this little moment in the miniseries when Baltar has the opportunity and she can't read the number. He's got it in his hand, and there's that moment of what's he going to do? And I don't know the honest answer to that. What was he going to do? Was he going to steal her number? Is he that despicable?
Well, again,
he's right in the...
And I don't know if people notice. I mean, I never quite see it. But, her glasses are on her head.
Yeah,
and
I only saw
he glances up at her head and sees her.
He actually sees them.
One reason why I'm a better choice than one of the greatest minds of our time.
You
can do this without me. I know you can.
Grace Park, who plays Sharon here, is also someone who came to us not with a great deal of experience, and so it was really rising to the occasion. She really had to step up to carry a lot of the stuff.
Get
and in this sequence in particular of her acknowledging that she's got to say goodbye to her partner, this is someone who she has a connection to, and in the midst of all this death and destruction, to leave the one person who you've got a connection to behind is the most excruciating thing to do, and she has to pull it off without, you know, falling apart and behave believably as a pilot would in a situation like this while maintaining that undercurrent of pain and despair. I really thought she found a way to do it, and at the same time, she's got the innocence which sort of goes against all of that, because you expect someone of this age to just sort of fall apart, and she does hold it.
Yeah, this is a military that hasn't actually seen war for 30, 40 years. They're all 20-somethings, as is the truth about most of the military. So she has that freshness, that innocence, that sort of great tomboy energy which Grace naturally possesses, you know, and she has the chops to go deeper to deal with these deeper moments of loss and separation.
Now, of course, we have the fun of the Blade Runner gun blowing the guy's guts out of his back.
Mike Mitchell doing a great job as the stunt supervisor and stuntman in that case. Again, we wanted everything to be visceral. You see the projectile travel, hit him, blood spurt. Again, it's quick, but it meant a lot to us to try to make all that feel real.
I love that people went over to him. In this shot...
Last shot of the day, barely got it.
This shot is probably what, you know, brought this character back for the series.
Yeah,
it's exactly. That moment, the heroic moment, and you kind of go, God, I wish that I could see that character again.
Well, everyone loved Tammo and is horrified that he wouldn't be around.
Now, for anyone paying attention to these cockpit scenes aboard the Colonial One, pay close attention to the African-American actor playing the co-pilot. He is the best extra ever to appear in a motion picture.
Giles.
he was a regular extra now on the show, and hopefully with, you know, the approval of these two people in the room with me, he might even get a speaking part one day. I don't know.
Well, I don't know how much of it remains in the cut, but there are always these wonderful little bits of him looking like he's about to say something and then thinking better of it. This is one of my favorite shots. Joel Ransom, the DP, who sort of married the documentary style with this sort of blown-out, glowy look. It's really beautiful, and at the same time holds the reality. And this sort of, that tracking shot coming down the Colonial One was one of my favorite shots in the mini.
How far down?
43rd in line in succession.
And this is one of my favorite scenes with Mary. She knows, they both know, they kind of know what's going to happen. There's an inevitability to the sense that she's probably the only one left. She's probably going to be the president. And it's, you know, it's that, this is the last moment before the weight of that will land on her shoulders. And it's, in a way, it's the last time she can be truly human in front of somebody.
Now, of course, as you watch the scene, the... thing that was always striking to me, and one of the reasons why I'm always amazed at what you learn when you embark on a project of this size, the star field out those windows is basically a black drapery. You know, we're on a soundstage, and as we were lining this up, we talked about it during prep. I didn't quite believe it, and I looked and I said, "So that's it?" And Gary Hutz looked at me and said, "Yeah." I said, "So we're going to shoot through these windows, and the audience will see out the windows, and they're just going to see that curtain, and everyone just goes with it and thinks that that's outer space." He said, "Yeah, and you watch it now, and it kind of works. I guess that's what they do in all these things." But
it bothers me terribly, that especially when you track across them and they move.
I know. So this is the LBJ Air Force One shot. We literally had, it was in the script, we literally had the photo taped to the monitor of Lyndon Johnson swearing in.
I just want to say one more thing about the last scene about Mary, which applies to this as well. Is as an actor, she's not anxious to show or demonstrate what she's feeling. Maybe it's a TV thing that people think, oh, well, I've got to stop them surfing, or
I've got so few beads. She'll have a moment, but try to hide it in a way, and you can see past that and see into her eyes.
Well, and in this moment, her behavior here and that handshaking, and writers months later who we've spoken to, and directors, the director who's directing now the episode 2, talk about that scene and that moment, and Mary so delivered the emotion and was able to convey that very complex idea, and it really resonated. It became, in the minds of many who saw this, a very trademark moment of the miniseries. It spoke to the ideas in general.
26 walked out. 85 didn't.
This whole bit of business of, you know, Tyrrell downstairs dealing with the aftermath of the fire, the human cost, how many people died in the attack. I mean, there was some people who watched the miniseries and said, well, I really wish we had gone and seen the fleet destroyed. I wish we had seen the Cylons, like, destroy the entire battle fleet, and that would have been cool. Well, you can make the argument that that's a cool thing to go see on a strictly visual candy special effects extravaganza, but this moment, you know, the real
Mickey's
human
performance
cost,
here says more about loss,
absolutely,
and death, than the makeup on Michael's face, or
which isn't bad,
100 explosions.
No,
yeah, I disagree with that comment. It actually takes away from the doco feel.
Yeah, I agree.
Because in life, you don't see everything.
No, you don't. We're telling
you
it
hear
from,
about it.
We're telling the whole story from Galactica's point of view.
This was a scene that was added in part because we began to understand that Aaron was as good as he was.
It's also a key telling moment on Adama. I mean, the way he handles this, the step right into the guy's face, he makes eye contact here.
Yeah.
It's very low.
Yeah. Don't dick around with me here. Because this guy, even Aaron, as experienced as Tyrrell is, he's still a rookie. He's never seen combat. Mm-hmm. He's overreacting emotionally to the circumstances he's dealing with. And the warhorse veteran says, but you keep to the protocol.
46, sir. Resume your post, Chief.
And the staging here is great because, of course, now he's going to walk right by Ty and hold his tongue. And that performance also works because we've established now that Tyrrell barks a lot, yells a lot, is a big mouth. So when he gets quiet, and when he starts to whisper, that's when you know he's really furious.
I think the other thing is Aaron is a lot younger than you imagined the character.
Yeah. He is.
You could imagine a crustier, more gnarled old guy running the floor.
That was the archetype, because when I was thinking about the relationship, I was interested in having a pilot and the crew chief having a forbidden love affair as another texture of the reality of the world, and, you know, putting men and women on warships together, and things happen like this. You know, they do have forbidden romances. They do get together because men and women are still men and women. And I wanted to play some of that, and I wanted to play also, you know, that it was difficult and it put them in an awkward position. And I sort of, then I started to, I think on some level, I thought, well, let's get even more clever than that. Let's make him older as well. He's, you know, he's not a kid. She's young. He's older, but she's his superior officer, and he has to report to her. So I thought all those sort of things would come into play. And then you cast Aaron. And Aaron is much younger, more ruggedly handsome, and it just gives it a different flavor. But it's also nice to see that, you know, the crusty crew chief is not the old crusty guy. You know, it's actually nice to have to sort of break that archetype as well.
Who's a senior officer? Who's in command? Send a message.
So again, you know, I would have said Candace's, you know, close up when she hands him that piece of paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Says more than all the explosions we could have stuck in.
Geminon liner 1701, this is Colonial Heavy 798. Well, strike dive. This is Colonial 1.
You can also kind of see there's, you know, we're making an attempt to sort of draw distinctions in how these different vessels are operated. This, what has just become Colonial 1, feels like an airliner. It's a big 747 and taking people around. The cockpit plays like like a cockpit does, the way pilots speak. You have that sort of feeling going on. And you're on Galactica, we treat it like an aircraft carrier, like a naval vessel. There's a CIC, there's ranks and protocols. You're mixing up sort of the environments, and all spaceships are not exactly the same. All spaceships don't have captain's chairs, and all spaceships don't have view screens. And, you know, we're sort of mixing up the environments and making it a more interesting world.
That we are currently involved in rescue operations, and we require...
So this is the beginning of the Laura Adama conflict. Yeah, almost unconsciously she starts reacting, provoking.
Yeah, from the very beginning, their relationship. Yeah.
And I love the scene, because I just love the way she puts Lee on the spot and says, well, yes, I know you're Adama's son, but I'm going to treat you as an adult with your own set of obligations and responsibility.
The great thing about creating these two characters, because, of course, in the original Battlestar Galactica, and in most stories like this, there's the one patriarchal commander. And I thought the great idea that Ron had about separating the responsibilities, so that you had a military commander and you had this person who's eventually going to rise to a position of head of social governance, was a way of creating conflict where in those other stories you can't, because the one person is sort of all things and they tend to be sort of idealized and perfect. And by separating them into two people, now you can have inner turmoil actually play out as drama between two people, one taking one side of the argument, the other taking the other. And that's something we're not only exploring in this series, but also flipping, so that when you expect one person to have one point of view, they might have the opposite.
And there's also something vaguely unsettling and, you know, fascistic about having the military commander be also the commander of all these 50,000 civilians that I was never quite comfortable with.
Right. Your ship's FTEL functioning. That's affirmative. That little beat that's there that went by, and you did so well, is your ship all right?
Yeah.
Which is a really hard thing to do right. It was in the script. It's why this space opera where you've got all these family relationships I'm playing works for me, because it's not just taken for granted. It is a problem for all these characters that they're related and they have this history and baggage.
It's like, yeah, they're professionals and they have to do their jobs, but they're still human beings and they still know each other, and all this stuff colors all their decisions and their choices.
Well, and almost here, I mean, Eddie made a very conscious choice from the beginning, which was to play, you know, sort of the Steve McQueen or the Clint Eastwood style commander. He's not pontificating. He's certainly not James T. Kirk.
Well, he's not used to having people argue with him.
Yeah, and so he has the stoic sort of countenance about him, and so on the one hand, people might criticize that and say, well, you know, gee, he's not talkative enough, or he's not charismatic enough. But what works about it is that when he does need to emote, when he does get angry, or when his heart does break, or when he does have a moment of self-reflection, it's so resonant, because you're so used to seeing this man so comfortable in his own skin and so either incapable or unwilling to emote, that when he does, it's really effective and surprising.
It's also little things like the way Duella sort of looks away, like, ooh.
Yeah, ooh,
I'm not used to, Commander Adama's not used to being spoken back to like that.
Yeah. Uh-oh. There's going to be trouble.
Raising his voice.
Yeah.
His
son is just being killed.
Mm.
And, I don't know if I'm giving anything away, but, you know, obviously Apollo isn't quite gone yet. But it's amazing when I watch it with people, I talk to them about it, I'm always surprised that they believe that we've actually killed one of the main characters.
Yes.
That people are able to suspend disbelief to go, oh, I'm not watching a contrivance.
And I think that's because we convinced them that we were capable of anything at this point. Yeah. We were literally capable of killing Apollo.
Cylon's moving off.
All the reactions feel very true in this moment.
Yeah, AJ is so great there with
And that we took the screen time to let the climax peter out into a much more gentle moment.
Yeah, the two men.
Yeah, that Michael would hug him there. Not directed or scripted to do that. But emotionally true.
I guess in about December of 2001, I got a call from David Kissinger who said, "One day you will look back on this conversation as the one that got you your house in the south of France." Which, by the way, hasn't happened yet, so I'm going to call my agent when we're done with this. But basically he said that they had been in development on a remake of Battlestar Galactica, which at the time was a continuation that they were doing with the team of Tom DeSanto and Brian Singer for the Fox Network as a two-hour pilot, backdoor pilot. And in the midst of the development, Brian Singer had been called away to X-Men 2, and that this had sort of undercut the development process, and they were back to square one, and were going to redevelop the project for their own network, for Universal's own network, Sci-Fi Channel. So David asked me if I was interested in pursuing it. I said yes, but only if I could start all over and not use any of the existing material, not use the existing script that had been developed. And he said, fine. And at that point, I called Ron Moore, who I'd met while I was at USA Network, and Ron was working, helping us out on a show called G vs. Z, and who I suspected, based on his background at Star Trek, might have a hunger or an appetite for approaching sci-fi in a way that perhaps wasn't allowed in that world. And we had a series of meetings, and to my shock, he said he was not only interested, but had a really amazing take on it. And there's been a lot of sort of apocryphal tales about how this incarnation of Battlestar Galactica came into existence, but that is the straight story.
You hear people say, or you would see people say on the internet, that, you know, Sci-Fi Channel dictated it certain ways, and they were insistent on this and that, and we absolutely had to destroy the old show, and none of that was true. I mean, it was all the creative decisions in this show, the fundamental ones, were all made by David and I, because this is just kind of the way we wanted to present the tale. I suspect that if we had gone in there and said, we want to pick up the old show and here's why, they probably would have been open to that conversation. There was
As long as that on some aesthetic level we were doing some different stuff, I think the agenda of the network was not so much to make it different from the original Battlestar Galactica as it was make it different from the other space operas that we already had peppering our network, both in first run and in syndicated programming. And they've had their share of Stargates and Farscapes and so forth, and so for them to go back into this arena was something they were only willing to do if they felt like there was a creative approach that was extremely different from what they already had.
I just want to say that was Boxy from the old show. We didn't. You did keep Boxy alive.
I did keep Boxy alive.
He did lose a lot of scenes in the mini, which were all very good. Connor is an excellent young actor, and I gather you're bringing him back, though.
He looks like he's 17 now, but
he's
changed,
and his character will change a bit too. And based on some of our discussions of what to do with Boxy in the series, as opposed to what to do with Boxy in the pilot, also just on a very tiny subtlety that virtually no one picked up on is the officer at the very beginning of the miniseries in Armistice Station. He's at that table.
They caught that.
Did they catch that? People catch that?
Somebody caught that.
Well, for those of you that don't know, there's a 8x10 glossy color photo on that guy's table of Boxy. He's Boxy's father. Boxy's father was in Armistice Station and died. And that's a very deep secret.
Just about the fans, I've been much gratified by when I do look on one of the boards, notwithstanding all the people who heap bile and vitriol on us, that the people who like the show get every little nuance that normally an audience misses. I mean, you know, all that stuff we put in there, I put in there quite consciously, they get everything, which is very gratifying and exciting to have an audience that appreciates something on that level.
It's interesting to see, too. I mean, there was such a variety of reactions from fans of the original series and how they responded to this reimagining. The one that surprised me the most were the people that objected
to all the references to the old show. And I had a conversation. I was up in Vancouver recently for the shoot, and I was walking down the street, and there was a comic book store, and I wandered into this comic book store and started looking for some comics, and I struck up a conversation with the guy behind the counter, and we talked about science fiction, and I baited him. I said, "So what do you think of the new Battlestar?" And this woman next to him at the counter said, "Oh, I really liked it, but man, I wish they had never referenced any of the old show." I said, "What? Really?" She said, "Yeah, you know, I just hate it. Every time they would say Starbuck and Apollo and hear the old theme song and talk about Boxy, I hated all that. I just wish they had never mentioned it, and that, you know, I could accept it as Galactica, but don't use any of the names." And I was just... I never understood that as a response. I don't know, because to me, as a fan of the old show, I would expect to be charmed by at least the homages to references from the old one and feeling like that the creators were, you know.
And you came up with the device of saying, well, it's not really their names, it's their call signs,
weird. There was a contingent of people that would have that accepted the show and liked it, but wanted to erase all the references to the old show, which I never quite understood. All right, and before we go on, this is one I must take responsibility for. I hate this sequence. I hate this scene.
Not the actor.
It's great what he shot. It's brilliant. Jamie, Mary, everybody. But the dialogue. It's just that when I wrote this sequence, I was trying to be a bit ironic and arch. And, you know, here's how Star Trek would deal with a situation like this. Star Trek will put you in a situation, and then they would techno-babble their way out of it with some double-talk thing about adjusting the flux capacitor to do X and Y. And so I sort of overwrote it intentionally as kind of an in-joke. And then we got deep into the process, and everybody kept saying, "But this is a bunch of techno-babble." And I said, "Well, yeah, it's kind of a joke." And nobody got the joke but me. And it's not really much of a joke. And the truth is, it's just kind of you write yourself into a corner for night one, which is to go out, and then you want to come back and sort of say, "Lee did something clever and got out of it." And I never quite cracked what this was. So it's kind of a preposterous...
We worked very hard to set up the energy coils, to establish them...
Yeah. It's still a very Trekkian moment whole thing.
It sort of makes me cringe, but I'm pretty sure we got away with it for the majority of the audience.
I think it kind of slides by.
The rest of the show paid off to the extent that they suspended disbelief, so they believed that Lee was dead.
Yeah.
And then it was just it was the child hearing the bedtime story in them that went, "Oh, but he's not dead." You know, they were just happy to find out that wasn't true, less fussed about the whys and wherefore.
And just move on.
About a year into the project's development, when we finally had a script and the studio network said that we had a green light predicated on finding a director, we set about looking for one. And I must have watched every science fiction film, television pilot, TV episode, good and bad, old and new, some we've never heard of. And I kept going back to this film I had seen some years ago called Angel Baby, which is an Australian, sort of an independent film about two mentally handicapped lovers. And I loved it because it was so human and because you were dealing with these people who were sort of caught up in another world or a world that was only their own, and yet they were in love and you sort of were with their journey. And that was directed by Michael. And so when we sat down to talk, I'd actually met Michael several years ago about a different project. And so when we sat down to talk about this, again, I think both Ron and I were struck by Michael's reaction to the humanity of it, and not to the effects, and not to the action, and not to...
Well, that was the last thing I wanted to
which
do.
Which is the last thing you wanted
to do. Oh, great, another action blue screen movie, you know, which is so boring to shoot, you know.
But the irony is, though, that in selling Michael, so to speak, to the company, we found ourselves pointing out, well, he did Queen of the Damned, because there were these action sequences and visual effects sequences in Queen of the Damned, which is a perfectly good movie, but not the movie that we were looking at as the reason to want him for this. So it's a lesson to you directors out there. You know, take whatever work you get. You never know when it's going to pay off for you down the road.
Well, very true. When I finally met Eddie, who signed on mainly because of the script, but all, you know, before he signed on, he went and checked out some of my work. And he looked at a film called In Too Deep, which was an African-American story about an undercover cop in the hood. So when I met him, he went, "You're not black?" He was, because he, you know, does a lot of, you know, ethnically based stories. So that was a payoff right there, that I had helped clinch one of my favorite actors to be in the show, which was a real coup for us to have someone of that gravitas, him in the show. So you never know what is going to lead to what.
Mm-hmm.
And just one more comment about Angel Baby. People have seen this miniseries, close friends and people whose opinion I really respect have said they think this is better than that. And I'm surprised because it's so different. It's such a mainstream genre film, but at the same time, it sort of proves this truism I believe in deeply, which is it all comes down to the screenplay. Angel Baby had a very well-conceived and thoroughly written screenplay, as did this, with great characters, the characters that you cared about, and events and twists that occurred that made you want to keep turning the page.
And in your case, you were having come off of Queen of the Damned, as I understand it. It instructed your agent in no uncertain terms to keep you away from anything with visual effects in it.
I wanted to do intimate. I wanted two people talking in a room. That's all I was interested in.
The first script you get is Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah. Well, I remember there was a lot of resistance from a lot of different avenues when we would send the script out from actors, directors, directors. It was the title would put people off, and we would have to say, no. Emphasize to your client this is a different thing, it's not what they expect. I mean, the title was a curse and a blessing, I think, all the way through the project. It was a blessing for obvious reasons. It's a franchise, it's a very recognizable name, there's a tremendous name recognition on this project based on a show that was on the air one season in 1978.
It's a testament to Universal's marketing might of that time.
Yeah, and it's never had a syndication package. Hasn't really been seen by the vast majority of the audience in 20 some odd years.
It's just a word people know, it's a phrase.
People
it was also released as a movie in Censoround.
That's right.
That broadened its awareness a lot at that time.
But on the curse, there was baggage that came along with it. That people didn't. You would send the script out to actors, and their agents would just say, "Oh, what are you kidding?"
Time we sent the script to an actor, I would have to get on the phone to the agent and say, "Just ask them to read it. Read the first 20 pages. I know that they're not going to want to, based on what they've done, but." And every time we got interest, it was always sort of in spite of what their expectations were.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so very much. Oh, Dr. Baltar, it's a pleasure to meet you. We met at last year's Caprica City Symposium.
Oh, yeah, of course, Sam. You'll have to forgive me. I'm bad with faces.
Oh, no, that's perfectly all right. I'm sure I wouldn't remember me either. Doctor, I need you to serve as my chief scientific consultant and analyst regarding the Cylons and their technology.
I'd be honored, Madam President.
Lieutenant Valeri, it's a pleasure.
At this point, you're loving Baltar in a weird way. You feel for him, you're into him, you like him, you feel kind of bad for this guy who caused the genocide of his entire race. It's such a bizarre place to be.
And again, I think Mary brings a reality to this. It's very underplayed, very simple. Okay, what do we do now?
Well, there's also
the world's ended.
There's a slight awkwardness she has about phrases like combat zone and Cylon, which is great because these are just not.
Yeah.
She's trying to sound like she says words like this, but she clearly hasn't. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because the character is presumably somebody. She's the Secretary of Education in this world. She's been in the Oval Office on Caprica. She's sat at the side of the president. She has watched the trappings of power and the moving the levers of power at close range, but she never, ever thought that she was going to be the one there. So she has something to draw on, but it's not natural to her.
Know what? There's a war on. Give me your...
It's a treat. I mean, we've all done a lot of different things, a lot of different movies and shows, but, to go into something where your two lead roles are both multiple Academy Award nominees, it's kind of a different level. This is Callum Keith Rennie, who's
a fantastic actor. Yeah. Also, very lucky to get him to play this sort of more obvious role, and he made it so unobvious. He added humor and complexity and all sorts of colors, which you'll see a bit later on.
It's also interesting, when you're making a movie, you have a studio that you're dealing with. When you're making a television show, you have a studio and a network. And the studio tends to work alongside the producers, and the network sort of functions as the buyer, and their comments and reactions are really rooted in their creative reaction to it. They don't really care what something costs necessarily. So we're about to get into a sequence that was almost the sequence that wasn't, in which Adama and Leoben crawl through the catacombs of Ragnar Station.
So talking about number six, I just want to point out about Trisha Helfer here. This is the hardest role in the mini. I would say the hardest role is Trisha, maybe the second hardest is Apollo, playing the straight hero for Jamie. But to play the sexy robot chick on paper has to look like the most thankless and demeaning and career-killing thing that you could take on. But I remember, you know, when Trisha came in for her, particularly her first audition, and she got immediately, she played this robot like an emotional, needy woman in love, even though she had this sexual power over this guy. She managed in her acting to transcend her own sexiness in a way. You know, I'm busy, you know, trying to make her look as sexy as I can. That's no mean feat.
No, and again, compounded by the fact that you're talking about an actress who, up until this, had basically never worked or done incredibly little work, precious little work. It's another testament to her achievement. I mean, this is Trisha's an actor who does her homework. She never comes to the set having not done a great deal of thinking about what she's going to do that day, and you know, it shows. And she's gotten even better in the early episodes of the show.
Conceptually, on the character and on the relationship with Baltar, I mean, the only reason that she's even in this at this point in the story is because, from the very beginning, David and I always considered this a pilot. This is a pilot for a series. It was never in our minds just a self-contained miniseries. This is all set up for series. You know, she is in a relationship with Baltar in his head, not so much to service the story needs of the events that happen in the miniseries, although they come into play in a certain way, and, you know, she sets up Doral, as you're about to see, and, you know, there's a small subplot that has to do with Baltar and Six. But in reality, she's there and he's on Galactica because I wanted them to be regular characters and players in the series later.
No.
Hey, take it easy, guys. Just slow down. We don't know much more than that. It's just imperative.
Now, this is a location in Vancouver.
This is Greg Callenby coming up.
What's in there? Stuff.
That's
stuff.
This is
the look that he gives.
The look he gives him.
This is a practical location that wasn't cheap to dress and leads to another expensive location. And when we ran into some financial troubles on our production, we changed this to an interrogation scene in which
the director was very grumpy about having to shoot the bomb with the flashing light.
Well, there is that, yes. There's a little beat coming up here that I think the comment after Daly's was, I've never shot anything so bad in my life. Let's enjoy it for a moment.
Be careful with that, all right? Hey, be careful with that!
Oh, the bomb! I think it's fine, but
it's fine.
Because then everyone, you know, everyone in the studio who's heard about how grumpy you were is like, see, it's fine, you know.
And yeah, then, exactly. And then it totally denigrates your grumpiness.
Well, the next time you've cried wolf, it's like, oh, he'll be fine. He carries on, but
now, can we just take a moment and say that whoever was inside the smoky thing reading their dialogue must have really been a trooper.
Must have been an executive producer.
Must have been somebody's committed.
Again, you know.
I love the choice that that he made here, where he wakes up laughing, which is such an unexpected, strange reaction. But
because these colonials are so hopeless, they if they don't blow themselves up, nothing works. But you know,
but
he's laughing, having a great time. Which makes Adama particularly grumpy. You know, it's like he feels humiliated and like almost explains to me why he doesn't let them cut him out. It's like, no, because you'll screw that up too. You just do your job. I'll get back.
Try not to kill anyone before I get back.
Listen, we're
going to
go out another way,
sir. I don't think that's a wise idea.
You got your orders. Tell Colonel Ty he's in command until I return.
Yes, sir.
Originally in the script, it wasn't a grenade that fell. I described the cargo bay there as some big elaborate contraption, and there was pallets of weapons all over the place, and it was a big overhead crane that had too much weight on it, and the crane gave way, and the crane crashed, and that sealed Adama, and blah, 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 which all looked good on the page, and then it's like, okay, how much
late
at
night going, I know, it'll be a big crane that crashes.
It was, like, ridiculously expensive.
So this is probably our weakest day in terms of the getting the look down. This was early in the shoot. We were still kind of grappling for it.
Yeah, it was a tough location. Obviously, it never occurred to me until I'd got into this that doing a space show is really hard because you have to come up with all these interiors. You can't build them all. You don't want to have to build them all for just one or two scenes.
Right.
So we found this rainforest in a dome in Vancouver and decided to use that to base the concept of the ship less how you'd written it, actually, but more like Silent Running, I guess.
Yeah, more Silent Running. And I think the whole exterior of this particular ship is actually lifted or an homage, or however you want to look at it, to a particular ship from the original series. They had these specific domes that looked exactly like that.
I think the Bryan Singer version also.
Did it? Did the Singer version have the same thing?
The main vehicle was this world that had these biodomes.
Mm-hmm. Spaceport. I see. We're going out for dinner, and I'm having chicken pie.
There's the chicken pie.
Chicken pie, hey. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's so funny, because I think David and I, we had discussed at an early point, well, do they have dogs and cats and things like that? And we said, no, let's not go there, because that locks us into a whole terrestrial kind of, like, thing, and we'll just avoid any mention of it. Nobody even, like, registered that we had chicken pie the whole time, like, in retrospect. Oh, I guess they're chickens.
But they're purple.
They're purple chickens, yeah.
Message from Lieutenant Valeri. She's found a fuel refinery ship. Filled with tellium.
I'm so glad we used that take, because in every other take, Jamie said, filled to the brim with tellium.
Filled to the brim?
Yeah.
Filled to the brim with tellium.
Which was probably an Englishism. Maybe
it happens to be a coffee commercial.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, not everybody realizes Jamie is a British actor. Mm, yeah. And so he's fighting a British accent all the way through this, which is remarkable because many people don't even realize that he's not American.
No one I talk to ever knows.
I think that he put, not even fight, he nailed that. When we let everyone ad lib a little bit, and I'm of course Australian, so we'll never catch a lot of that.
Oh,
when someone says there's a bit of this or a bit of that,
that's interesting.
It never occurred to me that.
It's a great little spooky moment there, and then right away they're in crisis mode.
And this is one of the few instances, I believe, that you use the Steadicam beyond the
No, it was used elsewhere, but this is the first. Because it was used in the break in the card game, right?
In the card game, although it's cut up.
Of course, they're jogging.
Yeah, we felt that there was enough uses of it earlier that you wanted to have some sort of balance, that you didn't want this style to completely vanish in the story.
Although, in this particular case, as I recall, this was the last shot of the day, and it was either shoot a 360 and get out, or get
or
in trouble.
Go 5 hours into overtime. And
I remember when I watched the dailies on this that I really liked the choice of doing the 360, because so many times you'll see a director use that technique, and it never quite seems right. It seems artificial. It's just sort of, oh, watch how many times we can go around. And here, the way it flowed and the way everybody said their line in which particular order and how it just really emphasized the nature of this, like, really tight.
Well, it's a Woody Allen shot, to the extent that you have actors in their coverage when they speak their line, and then you end up in an organic close-up for Laura's last line, and it's all one shot.
But, well, plus, it is a rather radical bit of camera moving, but given the circumstances, mm-hmm. it took the pressure off the actors having to sort of over-dramatize what they were doing. They could sort of keep it within the realm of reality, and the camera was telling the audience, oh, this is, we've upped the ante now.
Mm-hmm.
It's not selfish.
And then that lovely beat right there, where she has that private moment in the middle of all this crisis.
Well, I just thought...
It's interesting getting to know Paul, this actor, a little better over the last several weeks and getting the series off the ground. He happens to be a lethally funny mimic and can do entire passages from classic Monty Python. And, you know, you're standing there next to him, listening to him do this, going, I had no idea you would... with this kind of person. I mean, he's so good at selling
he's
this
very
officious.
Yeah, and makes fun of himself a lot.
But he's quite a funny guy. This was a ballsy move.
This is a ballsy sort of thing to do dramatically because, you know, it's not like the show hasn't been grim up until this point, but it just goes to a whole different place where, okay, there she is, Cammy, sitting on her bench. Playing with her thing, and you really are hoping against hope that the writers and everybody involved is going to find a way for Laura to go, no, wait, you know, I got an idea. There's a way we don't have to leave Cammy behind, too. But, you know, it really announces a seriousness of intent to the audience that says, you know, we're really not screwing around here. These are real events. There are consequences to every action. And it's one thing to play a scene where the characters stand around and make the heroic, noble, difficult decision. Oh, we've got to leave all those poor people behind that we've never gone and seen. And aren't we noble because we can make that sacrifice? It's another thing to intercut a scene like this between the characters that you love and the character of this innocent child who is about to be slaughtered due to the decision that they just made.
The great thing about Mary here is that, again, she plays the not just the despair and the horror of it, but also the utter insecurity. Is this what the president would do? Is this what a president does? And it's really, you know, it's a silent moment, and it's one of her best in the entire miniseries.
It's her initiation, or her loss of innocence. Mm-hmm.
And the music here, it's so low key. It's not bum bum ba da da dum dum da 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 dum dum.
Or very maudlin and emotional.
No.
Richard Gibbs made a great choice
to
play against that. I think the word I use is give me something Kubrickian.
Yeah.
Which is a new word we've come to use a lot.
Yeah.
And he did it. You know, he really nailed
it.
Very
Kubrick,
this is what it is. We're not going to make you feel anything. In fact, we're going to let you pull you back from that.
Which in a weird way draws you further in.
So this scene, which was always in the original script, in which Leoben begins to lead Adama deeper into the guts of Ragnar Station, was, as I was mentioning, out of production necessity, rewritten to be an interrogation scene where Adama takes Leoben back onto the Galactica, basically bolts the door, and we play the ultimate NYPD Blue interrogation scene between Commander Adama and Leoben. And when the network got these revisions, apparently they had never been told that we were in financial trouble and that they were necessary. So understandably, they said, guys, we really always loved the walk through the corridors of Ragnar Station and don't really understand why we have to now settle for less. And this became quite a standoff between the network and the studio until finally, through a combination of network breakage and the studio approving some overages, we were able to do this as originally conceived. And in retrospect, I have to say, I am grateful that the network caused the stink they did, because I do think that it's memorable. It also happens to be shot in probably one of the nastiest, ghastliest places in Vancouver, called Rogers Sugar.
Rogers Sugar Mill. You'll never eat sugar again unless you've been there.
But which probably contributed in some small way to our resistance to doing the scene.
By the way, breakage means... Where they give you more money.
Yeah, where the network...
They break open the piggy bank. I don't know.
It means they break budget, where the network contributes money to above and beyond the agreed-upon amount.
Well, I remember when that was all going down, and I was in Los Angeles, and I was working on Carnival, I would get these calls, and I did a pass on the... Okay, let's try it as an interrogation scene, and I did a quick rewrite on that in between producing stuff on the HBO series. And then there was this one surreal time, I don't know if you remember this, David, where you were on the set, and I think you were on the set at Ragnar with a laptop computer, and I was in my car driving down the 5 freeway from Valencia on my way home after, you know, 8 o'clock at night or something after a day at work, and I'm like dictating lines to you over my speakerphone on the car, and you're writing on a laptop off of the sugar mill telling me how insufferable and horrible it is and how you can't believe what I'm breathing right now and I'm going to die. And
oh, you were wearing these surgical masks that you would take off after an hour and they'd be black around the mouth. And you think to yourself, okay, this is what I'll be breathing in when the surgical mask wears out.
So again, I'm fond of this scene, I guess, as from the writing point of view, that suddenly we see the civil and military worlds in collision, and there's a power struggle going on, and everyone means well, everyone's trying to do the right thing, but there are prejudices and preconceptions in place that sort of, to me, conjure up a whole bigger world that existed before the destruction of the planet.
And this is also emblematic of the deeper approach to, you know, the civilian and the military world that we wanted to create in the series, in the miniseries, as opposed to the original series. Not to knock the original series, but in the original Battlestar Galactica, you have this sort of template of Adama as the all-knowing, all-seeing, wise leader, and whatever civilian government there was, the sort of quorum of 12 guys that wore, like, elongated togas that sat around a table, they were always idiots. And whatever those guys said we should do, you knew was the wrong choice, because Adama was the smart one, and those guys were morons. And you always knew that that was the case. And it was there was this implied message. Yeah, Ray Milan was in it. And there was this implied message that the military knows best and the civilians should just stay out of it. And I objected to that philosophically and just sort of fundamentally, but I didn't want to slam the military either, because I feel like in a functioning democracy, this is an uneasy but necessary partnership, that the military and the civilian have to work together, but that it's important to maintain that the civilian control of government and of life is an important thing, and that they have to have their own sort of reality and their own truth to what they're trying to accomplish, and that they're not just these straw men that say soft things and then are knocked down by the more, you know, hard.
It's also, again, analogous to post-September 11th, the whole reaction of we're in a state of emergency, we need the Patriot Act. And then people slowly start to say, ah yes, but the reason we're fighting is to protect certain freedoms that we now have to bring up, and that's really Laura's position.
Now, speaking of trying to balance, you know, the humanity with the darkness, this, again, a scene that in a number of cuts, as I recall, had to go because we were looking for, obviously, ways to fit 4 hours into 3 hours and change. And we ended up finding a way to put it back, and I remember feeling very strongly about it myself, because this is their moment. This is a moment to reflect on those who've been able to survive this and can take a breath and, you know, grab a hold of each other.
And by the way, Connor's reaction, I think, was scripted.
Now, a word about Richard Hugh Dolan, who's the sort of unsung hero of a lot of this. He's the production designer. Yes, Michael?
Oh, I just want to explain why this kiss happens, because there's a scene missing, or half a scene missing earlier in the bathroom, where Billy and Dweller have a lot more flirtatious.
Oh, yeah,
or
she's
interaction.
In her bare midriff, yeah. But this...
even in this cut, because I agree, the notion that, you know, after people all that's happened, the end of the world, you see this man that you had a moment of flirtation with, and you just kiss him, you know, it's like...
Which was always the intent.
It's a very post-9/11 reaction, when, you know, I'm on the phone, I remember... Literally the day after 9/11, I was on the phone with a man who was working at the garage where my car was in and being serviced, and I was just calling to sort of check in, you know, when I'm getting my car back, and the guy just started talking to me, just like I was his friend. I'd never even laid eyes on him. He's like, wow, what a thing that's going on, huh? I mean, I was sitting in my home. He started telling me his whole story, what he was doing on 9/11, and we just had this long conversation, apropos of nothing.
So that we don't leave out Richard, one of the big steps in getting this thing approved was, again, creating an aesthetic and an overall vision that cut against traditional space opera. And this was critical to the network, and I think both Ron and I and then Michael also agreed it was necessary. And Richard was had the sort of unenviable task of having to create kind of out of whole cloth a representation of this that was not in any way evocative of what was on the air. Ron and I had an idea originally about this being sort of a submarine, and that Das Boot was kind of the interior model for what we'd be doing. And unfortunately, that didn't go over at the end, and we were forced at the 11th hour to come up with something else that that would put it over the top. And I remember flying Richard Hudolin from Vancouver, where he's from, down to L.A. for a meeting with the network, where basically whatever he was able to present or however he was able to couch it was going to determine our fate. And fortunately, he had some drawings of these sets, which placed in the proper context and with enough color and splash, successfully put it over.
Richard is an amazing production designer because he has great taste and vision, but he also has incredible practical skills. He can make a set out of nothing. It's a miracle when you walk onto a location and go, oh my God, where did all this come from? And he, you know, he has a lot of experience getting the job done, which is, you know, it's one thing to have the vision, it's another thing to figure out how to do it. And so I'd worked with Rich and I knew that. But yeah, then he shows up in L.A., has this whole riff on
Frank Lloyd Wright,
and completely reinterprets essentially what were very similar.
Well, what were artistic renderings of principles that we'd already presented, but I don't think had elaborated on yet. And so by being able to make them into a whole idea, finally got us the green light.
While we're talking about Richard, let me mention Joel Ransom, who shot this. I mean, again, Richard and Joel did such an incredible job that it's almost invisible to me. I don't even see the sets and the lighting, but, you know, we certainly worked very hard to get the look we had under quite difficult circumstances.
Well, and
this
being the most difficult. Before we get to this very famous scene, I agree about Joel, and I really think few of us, until we're doing the big budget Hollywood movies, are going to get a chance to work with Joel again. I think he's probably on his way to the really big time. He's one of the classiest, and I think most artistic DPs that certainly that I've ever worked with, and you know, took our direction and did what we said. But really, a lot of what we're looking at here was what Joel wanted to do.
Yeah, totally. But and also just a very supportive energy on the set, who understood that the main job was to make the actors feel comfortable, and you know, he understood, like Richard, you know, the mechanics of how to get the job done in the time and that we had and the money we had to do it with. Which is, you know, Vittorio Storaro is one of my heroes. Mm. We'd still be shooting if he was the cinematographer, because it's a whole different thing when you have unlimited.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Money. To make it look like this on the schedule that we were that we had in front of us, and the limited resources and the tall order of make it look unlike any other sci-fi project on television, that's a difficult tightrope to walk. Now, of course, this is a battle between our hero, Commander Adama, and the man he now knows to be a Cylon, Leoben. And so it's Adama's realization, not just that this man is not who he thought, but that Cylons can now look like human beings. The fight scene, as it were, basically ends around here.
Well, originally we went to this location, our stunt guy came out and said, okay, here's what we're going to do. And although he's a very good stunt designer, essentially what he'd built was a very conventional punch-up, TV punch-up.
Eddie would have none of it.
And we all were not very excited.
It was not.
And Eddie said, hey, why don't I just stay here on the steps and beat the guy to a pulp?
With my flashlight.
And I said, love that. Great.
I thought it was a great change-up.
And we made that, and we cut it really well, and it looked great. And the network flipped out.
The network was not happy.
And suddenly, I get a phone
call. We want steam.
I'm like in the middle of some nightmare on Carnival, and of which there were many, and suffering and stuff. And David calls me and says, okay, I really need you to be on this conference call tonight because we got a problem with the fight. Have you seen the fight? No. I say as I look over at like three boxes of dailies that are still on my couch that I haven't waded through. Okay, the fight. All right, we're going to show you what the fight is. And the network hates the fight, and Michael loves the fight, and we got to fight about the fight tonight with the network. And if you could just kind of come in and help a little bit, that'd be fine. Okay, so somewhere around 8 o'clock, I mean, it was pretty late by the time everybody gets on the phone. Everybody gets on the phone, and hi, how's it going? Hey, Ron, good to talk to you, blah, blah, blah. Well, okay, so let's talk about this fight. And I'm sort of midway somewhere into saying, you know, well, I kind of like it for X, Y, and Z. And suddenly all hell breaks loose in a way that I've never been involved with on one of these calls where people are shouting at each other and cursing at each other. And all
network
like,
executives hanging
oh
up.
Oh, my God.
And
it was
back.
Just, it was unbelievable because I was at a distance, a physical and emotional distance from the project. And I was really focused on Carnival. And David was kind of keeping me in touch with what's going on. But I didn't really appreciate the pressures that everybody was under up in Vancouver trying to deliver this thing until that phone call, which was sort of a safety valve on the whole shoot, I believe. And all this sort of tension came out through the air, and I was like, oh, my God.
Let me say that in context that, you know, the network and studio generally were very supportive and helped us enormously, but this was the one thing we disagreed on. Not that I have a problem with the fight we shot. It was just given that we'd cut so many other things that I valued, do we really need to go blow all this money redoing it? And
not to mention going back to Roger's Sugar Factory on a Saturday.
Yeah, so, but it all worked. You know,
it all worked out. Yeah, by the end of the conversation, we were all like back on the same page. But it was sort of like, oh, I guess there's some tension up there.
And a nifty move, Michael said he would go ahead and go back to Roger's Sugar on Saturday to shoot these pickup shots of heads being thrust into steel, a lot of stuff that I ended up sitting down with Michael and the storyboard artist and designing, hoping beyond hope that Eddie would agree to do it. And Michael said he'd do it, but only if one of the network executives agreed to fly down and be there on the set while we shot it. So as if it wasn't awkward enough that we'd all had this knockdown dragout, now we're all together on a Saturday drinking coffee. Hey, how you doing? Oh, good to see you. People who had been screaming at each other 2 days before shooting these pickups. And I tend to agree. I look at it now, and there's aspects of the original that I like better. There's certainly a level of viscera about what we picked up that I think is fine and good. And so, you know, that's how these things
are. And I think Mike Mitchell came up with a stunt sequence that wasn't this standard TV.
Yeah, it wasn't a Walker Texas Ranger.
It had a reality to it. It was done fairly simply. And, it, you know, I was very happy with the result. You know, it's a good war story.
It is.
Especially when I'm trying to help you.
How are you trying to help me? How are you trying to do that?
See anything there that looks familiar?
So again, you know, here we have James Callis bringing quite a lot of humor to the part of Baltar that we'd never really automatically seen for ourselves.
It's also really nicely accentuated. This is probably my favorite music cue in the entire miniseries because it's somehow emotional. This is sort of Baltar's becoming, you know. This is a big transition for him. And in a way, it's a farewell to whatever strands of self he might have had before all this began. And I think the music really accentuates that idea.
This is a theme Richard came up with, which was sexy, ethereal, delicate, not too emotionally manipulative,
there's
simple.
There's a tension to it, too.
It's silent.
What's sort of like the, you know, the Battlestar Galactica version of a music box, in a way.
Hmm.
It's, in itself, fairly gentle, sweet, benign, delicate, but we've now imbued it with another meaning.
Right, and in this moment, he realizes
big horns and
he realizes he's going to have to pick a side.
So, the funny thing about all this stuff, I never had, you know, Ron was busy, so I actually never really had a lot of opportunity to chat about what all this meant when I was directing it. So I think I gave James quite explicit direction that, she is a chip in your head.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know that, but you're a scientist and you think, well, it's quite plausible. And how would hallucinations form like this? And it wasn't until the show was finished cutting, Ron said to me, well, no, I think it's probably that he's having a mental breakdown. I wish you told me that back when, but it doesn't matter because if he doesn't know, we shouldn't know.
We shouldn't know, and that was always key to, and it still is, even going into series, is that we never answer the question, is she a chip in his head or is he having a psychotic break? And I was careful when I was writing it to never have her say something to Baltar that he couldn't have intuited on his own.
Which I realized later, but I...
We never had that discussion. I'm glad that there was never you never actually decided to do something else.
And I had no idea you told him that. I really didn't. I thought all along he knew exactly what we were intending.
I forgot to mention, I'm familiar with their technology because I'm having sex with a Cylon for the last 2 years now.
As your Trisha goes into a little British accent.
Well, again, trying to find, you know, the edges and the depth of this character, this robot woman. We've got to let her become a bit ironic, make fun of Baltar.
No, that would be our little secret.
I love the fact that he gives himself over to it. And the moment he lets her reach down his pants, he's sitting in CIC. He just kind of goes there.
All right, now I can talk about this because everyone who's watching this commentary hopefully has watched the show properly.
Yeah.
So most of you listening will know that Matthew Bennett's character is also a Cylon.
What?
So the question is, does he know what's happening to Baltar at that moment, being a Cylon?
Mm.
Well, it depends on whether or not it's a chip in his head or he's having a psychotic break.
Yeah.
But either way, does a Cylon know these things?
Oh. I don't think so.
I
don't think so.
He doesn't seem the type, and I don't remember seeing him at any of the Cylon parties.
That's another indication of the irony.
Yeah.
So, again, you know, Trisha brought to this a very solid understanding of what it was that she had to do, that what it was her character had to do, and obviously she was directed quite well here as well, but she's informing him, she's spooking him, and she's also making fun of him a little bit.
Yeah. It's interesting on number six, you know, I mean, there were ideas we talked about in the, you know, the primeval era of this project where we were talking about the Cylons and the reasons why we decided to make them human instead of, you know, going with more robotic or suits or CGI, and some of that was driven by production in terms of, well, how many, you know, really cool suits could we afford to make on any kind of series? Not many. How many CGI Cylons could we afford to do each week? Well, not many, and not very well on a TV budget. And then you start talking about humans, and then as we talked about making them humans, that became a creative, then, well, actually that's better because it says something about them as a culture. It says that they evolved to that place, and why do they want to take the human form? And it speaks to sort of their religion. There were a lot of sort of interesting thematic reasons why we decided to make them human beings. It made the colonials responsible for them in a more direct way. It made the metaphor of, you know, humanity as the parents of the Cylons more literal. It made the enemy have a literal human face as opposed to just sort of mechanistic, easy to hate kind of, you know, stormtrooper visage. There were a lot of those good reasons, but even as we developed the script and shot it, we didn't really lock into a lot of different aspects of the Cylons and who they were until now we're in the series.
Right.
And we're starting to realize that a lot of things that we set up in the miniseries that we didn't even realize at the time have greater meaning. You know, the fact that there are 12 Cylon models, which, you know, is something that she says, and she's number six. Well, why are there only 12? And that's something that we're starting to explore.
Well, also looking at our own sort of criminal dysfunction of our society, where, you know, people develop all sorts of strange
justifications and reasonings behind behavior. And, you know, we talked at one point about how, you know, even when you look at religious cults and, you know, these ideas about cultural lineage that develop, and even, you know, like the Manson family thinking that they were freeing you by killing you, and, you know, it was their turn to inherit the earth. And a lot of these things sort of played a role in developing the Cylon point of view and their kind of macro plan.
I just want to leap back into the scene here when we were shooting this.
You mean the fact that they didn't want to hug?
Well, yeah, both actors had a very strong feeling that, no, we're not going to hug here. No, right. It was written.
Right.
And, you know, so I was sort of struggling with the dilemma of, well, how's this going to work? And, of course, they did. But then the brilliant thing is after the hug, they had that moment of awkwardness where they don't know what to do about that hug. And part ways and go back to being, you know, men's men. This was a tough scene. I was really looking forward to the moment, this is quite late in the shoot, where the Baltar thread of the story got to meet the Adama thread, and what was going to happen between them, and what was Adama going to make of Baltar.
Mm-hmm.
As it happened, it was a nightmare to shoot because Eddie and Michael couldn't keep a straight face. I mean, they were cracking up take after take because James was doing nothing. He was really not provoking, but couldn't, you know, he was just so funny. And then there was a beat at the end that they ad-libbed, which was, you know, the Baltar gets up and says, right, Captain, I'll get right on it and I'll build you a Cylon device. And they're looking at each other going, well, if we're in his hands, we're in deep trouble. Which we couldn't use because we had to really believe that they believed him, that he got away with all of this.
And that's a delicate line because the audience knows he's covering, and he has to kind of convey that he's covering to the audience. But
have enough sincerity that you don't feel like Adama's being played the dope.
Exactly.
It continues to be a tough line.
Yeah. Well, it keeps James honest to the extent that he has to, whatever he does, if, you know, an actor like Edward or Michael says, well, I'm sorry, I can see that you're not being sincere here, they'll call him on, in a, you know, on camera, yeah, on a line, and they would have to adjust.
Lee, Zach failed basic flight.
This was another one of those audition scenes, yeah, that everyone had done 100 times, and I know Katie and Jamie were not happy with the result, but I had to assure them that it was because they'd done it 100 times and that it was fine and it was all there.
Well, we talked about, you know, how the most positive and creatively successful aspects of this are the ones you don't see, and one of those for me is Katie Sackhoff's performance. She's so good, and so good in the face of all of this criticism and resistance that she knew she was facing just playing a character of this name. And again, someone who's had some experience, but really for the most part is an unknown, who I'll admit, and I think, Michael, you shared this, that it's not like when she walked in, we all fell down and said, there's Starbuck.
Katie walked in and we said, she's too pretty and too soft to play Starbuck.
Right. And actually, I mean, from, I don't know how you came around from my end, I was rolling tapes in the master bedroom, kind of frustrated, not sure what to do. And my wife, Jenny, who's, you know, been with me through the Xena days and through all the casting of strong women and even in cartoonish stuff like that, Katie came on, and I think I wasn't even looking, and she looked at me and said, are you crazy? She's great. Why are you guys, you know, arguing this point? Look at her. She's so.
I don't know. When I came around, I think it was in her network test where, under great duress, basically she and Jamie were head and shoulders above the other people working, who were all very talented. So it became very easy. And then we had the read through, and we all looked at each other and went, "Boy, did we cast the right person?" Because,
yeah,
you know, on many levels, Katie is Starbuck. She is as irreverent and fearless and messed up as Starbuck. But she's also a very talented actor, so she created a character that's a lot tougher and more badass than she is as a person.
Right.
And at this point, I think she just owns the role. I mean, she is Starbuck.
Yeah.
You know, she is, of all the people on the production, probably second only to me, she took more flack than anybody in terms of the response from people who were, you know, very wedded to the old show and unwilling to sort of give the show a chance. The fact that we had changed Starbuck to a woman was the first big kind of flash that went across the internet that got major kind of reverberations.
She's been a lightning rod to abuse.
She's been a lightning rod to abuse. She got a lot of abusive fan letters and phone calls and mail and just sort of reactions. And Katie, you know, it didn't throw her. I mean, I'm sure it was hard, but it never threw her, you know, all the way down the line. And she's great. And now she is Starbuck. I mean, Dirk Benedict is Starbuck of the old, and no one will ever take that away from him. And he created that character. But she is our Starbuck.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, and just to talk a little bit about the reaction, I mean, what had happened when David had first approached me about the project and we decided to do it, I was under the sort of naive impression that the Battlestar Galactica fan community, as it were, would just be delighted that anybody was doing this, that somebody was finally going to make the
show. Any version of it.
Any version. I thought they were going to just be beside themselves. And I had sort of surfed around the internet a little bit and looked at the existing Battlestar Galactica sites, of which there were only a handful, and kind of read some of the boards. And most people at that point were just sort of still bemoaning the fact that the DeSanto Brian Singer version had collapsed, and oh my God, we're back to the same place, and no one's ever going to make our show. And I thought, well, gee, these guys are going to be thrilled. Wait till they hear I'm doing it, and I'm the Star Trek guy, and you know, it's really going to happen. And lo and behold, the initial press release went out, and it said that we were doing a reimagining as opposed to a continuation, and people just lost their minds. They were
the
so
shit hit the fan like you wouldn't believe. It became total damage control scramble. I was getting phone calls. Ron was getting phone calls. It was pandemonium, and it really culminated in a pretty interesting way. By the time I, as a matter of necessity, had to stop paying attention to all this and start focusing on producing the miniseries, we had had our first media day with the cast of the miniseries, and all of us were there, and the press is asking, we're doing a Q&A, we're all on the panel, and one of them asks Eddie what he thinks about the fan reaction, and Eddie says, basically, let me tell you something. To the fans of the original show, Battlestar Galactica, I have one suggestion. Don't watch it. Just don't watch it, because it will only be painful. Turn it off.
And I was sitting next to him, and I looked over him, and just beyond Eddie was the president of the network, Bonnie Hammer, who was standing at the podium, and all she could do was smile. And I knew that inwardly she wanted to reach out and grab Eddie and yank him off the stage, but there was no way. And she just stood there with complete aplomb. Bonnie never,
she never blanched.
Never blanched. And Eddie just went with it. And
Eddie hadn't intended this, but if anything made them watch the show.
Oh, my
God.
Absolutely.
As soon as it was over, we all, our time on the stage was done, and we all kind of left. And I was in the bathroom, I think, with David.
Where Ron and I usually are.
Yeah, where we usually are, 9 times out of 10. And I said, one of us said to the other, that's the best publicity we're ever going to get. And it's absolutely true.
I had been to a number of those as an executive, and so I knew that typically you've got these members of the press who are all bored to tears. They've been there all day. They're looking for the food tray. They're positively desperate for anything interesting to talk about or to write about. And I've been to a number of these where their boredom is palpable. And I know when Eddie said that, you just saw all of them come alive and, you know, get animated, and they were all laughing and amused by it. And he kept asking him to retract it. They kept giving him,
they gave him a chance to, are you sure?
Yeah.
Is that really what
you don't really
say?
Mean don't watch it, do you? Yes, that's exactly what I mean. Don't watch it.
And it's great because then, sure enough, every story after that started out with, Edward James almost does not want you to watch his show.
Yeah, exactly.
It was such a great lead that then they all wanted to write the story.
It was like the best PR campaign you could have asked
for. It really was, because I had tried the opposite tact. I had tried going online and talking to the fans and trying to reach out and saying, we understand you're upset, and try to make various... And they were just having none of it. It just wasn't going anywhere. And Eddie's just kind of like, well, you know what? Don't watch it. Was much more effective.
Well, Eddie is a very active in the Hispanic community, the LA community, the larger American community. He's always you know, making appearances and doing stuff for charity, for causes. So he's very engaged in the world. So when suddenly anyone assaults him with abuse and negativity, I mean, he was getting, I don't want to exaggerate, but, you know, I don't know if it was death threats, but very angry hate letters. And he had to do something about that.
I mean, all that fan reaction just kept going for quite a while. And there was a lot of sort of like wondering how this was all going to turn out. I knew there was a lot of publicity. The controversy was working for us because it was getting people sort of like, oh, well, what's going on with that Battlestar? I hear there's all this like problems and this and that. And the fans hate it. And I just knew, oh, that's great. Publicity's good. Any publicity's good. The nadir of the entire experience was when they tested this. When they did a test screening of
well,
this.
Which I think we may have spoken about after we knew we had the story. I'm sure it was early enough in the process. I remember saying to you, this is going to test in the toilet.
Yeah.
You know, we're breaking every rule. You're not supposed to do any of this. And
I had just sort of dismissed that. Like, oh, well, you know, come on, it'll test well. People will see it's great. And then they did test it. And they tested it in two cities. I don't remember which two cities they
Dallas was one of them.
And somewhere else. Oh, Chicago. Mm-hmm. Dallas and Chicago. And we knew the test was going on, and they're run by, you know, some outside. They're not run by the studio themselves, right? They're run by some outside firm who conducts them, recruits
in concert
them.
With the network, actually. And then like network. Weeks went by, and we didn't hear anything. Like no one was talking to us about what happened.
And then I get this call from David saying, "Okay, the test results are in. It's really bad." Wait, what? So he's like, "You don't even trust me. You don't even want to read it. They hated." Everything about it. They hated everybody. There's nothing. And I was like, oh my God. And I never read the full report. Like, David spared, eventually sent me just like the executive summary. And it literally said things like, there's no audience identification with this show. There should never be a series. No one will watch this. They hate everything about it. Give up. From that point on, I never lost faith in it, but I was like, man, maybe we see something nobody else does. And then the premiere came. And the night one numbers were strong, not stellar, but strong. And we all felt good about it. And I remember everybody calling each other the next day saying, okay, this is the number. Okay, it's good. It's strong. It's not fantastic. It's good. Okay, what's the drop-off going to be? Because there's just traditionally, by the boards, night two of any miniseries or two-parter kind of thing, night two is always going to be lower than night one. Okay, well, if it drops off by this much, that's great. If it drops off by that much, boy, we're in trouble.
Well, to be specific, Night One had done a 3.2, and the network had said, as long as we don't do much worse than a 2.8 in Night Two, so that we average out at a 3 rating, I still think we'll be talking about series. Night Two numbers come in. We're hoping for a 2.8. We're hoping for a 2.8, 3.8. And it was like mind-blowing.
It was. It was just nobody goes up on the second night. It was just startling.
So it did tend to, I think, vindicate what we had hoped.
It was true. For me personally, that's when I felt true vindication. Yeah. I felt like, yes, this was right. The decisions we made, the way we decided to go, it's right, and it works.
Hi.
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 Hey,
I'm getting ready to head back to the transport.
When the show premiered, we had a premiere party before it was actually broadcast, and they just showed Night One. They showed it at the Directors Guild Theater in Hollywood.
Huge screen.
Big screen, big audience, auditorium, packed house, and it was our first opportunity to see it actually projected up onto a big screen, and I was really impressed and surprised how well this held up on a big screen.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people afterward came up and said, you know, you could release this as a feature.
So now maybe this is a good chance to point out Richard's main set. You know, this is the CIC. Again, there's no view windows. There's no sort of hierarchical structure with a big captain's chair. Adama wanders around, as does Ty. It is multi-level. It goes up maybe three or four different levels. And each part of the set has a specific function. There's a navigation section, there's a weapons section, there's a communication section, and we've tried to stay true to that, even though no one else is going to notice.
we're running.
Yeah, there are clearly defined functions and consoles to the entire CIC. I mean, when I approached this and was laying out sets, and again, when I was writing the script, I was thinking about series and pilot and, you know, what would be the standing sets. And I knew that I wanted to break away from the Star Trek model. I mean, when Star Trek, and, you know, I hope nobody takes this for wrong, I don't mean to slam Star Trek. I was at Star Trek for 10 years. I loved it. I grew up with it as a kid. I adore the original series. But what has happened over time is that the choices that Gene Roddenberry made in the mid-60s in terms of how you do a science fiction series then became the standard by which everybody else did this genre. Everybody then decided that you have to have a captain's chair, it has to be a bridge, you got to have a big giant view screen, which is a window looking out into space. And that became the template that everybody else felt obligated to follow. And, you know, that's just one way to do it. And they did it well, but, you know, real aircraft carriers don't have big windows that people look out of, you know. The captain goes down inside the ship and sits in a combat information center, and this is, you know, the nerve center at Galactica is well inside, and he's not looking out at space, because why would he need to look out at space? He would, you know, deal with, you know, charts and graphs and small consoles and the people around him.
Well, you did a lot of research into aircraft carriers and how they run.
I was, and just as a personal interest, I had grown up in my father was a Vietnam War veteran, and I was always interested in the military growing up, and I had been a Navy ROTC midshipman in college for a time, and I was a bit of a military nerd in addition to being a science fiction nerd, so, you know, there were many aspects of nerddom I was up on. And I was very familiar with the carrier battles of the Pacific War in World War II and the functions of aircraft carriers. And I had gone out and done a weekend, you know, visit on an aircraft carrier when I was working at Star Trek and watched flight operations and stood on a carrier deck. And I was just fascinated by them and thought they were amazing, you know, machines of war. And the men and women that manned them did these unbelievable jobs. And one of the reasons why I wanted to do Galactica was because it was an aircraft carrier in space, and it was a chance to do that sort of template.
I guess it was a part of the negotiation with the network to not go too downbeat in terms of things looking too grungy, too tight, too dust boat.
Well, and
they
part
wanted
of that,
a little scope. Right?
Yeah, part of that, again, from their perspective, they were looking at it very practically. They had this show Farscape, which was a much different idea, but which had a very grungy kind of down and dirty quality to its ships. And when you're in the position of programming and trying to offer a broad audience a lot of variety, you look at things like that. You say, well, we don't want to do another interior that has that down and dirty quality, even if the ideas are different or if the context is different. So here we have the first reveal of the base star, which was an idea introduced in the original Battlestar Galactica, and which, again, I believe, was it Richard that designed the new base stars, or Hutzels, Peter Zoek? I can't remember who designed
them. Yeah, I remember seeing it for the first time and being struck by this
starfish,
organic...
Yeah.
It's very organic looking thing, which I thought was very intriguing and scary.
And this shot,
I don't know who to give credit to.
Well, this shot is another.
I think Gary's team were just busy making up infinite numbers of spaceships. If it was Richard's team, I apologize.
Here, I think coming up here, this shot here, where we travel with the ammunition and then it blows apart.
Yeah.
Is again, it's sending shrapnel every conceivable direction. Is one of the things that again gives you a point of view into a battle that I don't think you've seen quite before.
And also, you know, note that when these silent ships explode, they don't just vaporize into fire. If you slow it down, you can see there's parts, there's debris. Right. We told them, well, you know, how does fire actually work in space? What does a fireball actually, like, do? And it, you know, there are things that will ignite, but then they go out rather quickly, and then there's a lot of debris left.
This was a challenging sequence in terms of making the geography and the strategy of what was happening clear. It demanded a lot of shots, and we were under pressure to minimize the number of visual effects shots. And we had spectacular ones like this is one of my favorites. It's that sort of, oh shit,
and then you hear that,
why would I want to go into that,
that
sort of
like,
feeling.
Whoa.
You also have the Cylon machine gun sound effect, which is a
a descendant of the Blackhawk sound effects, where the mechanism is so fast it almost sounds like a piece of paper being torn in half. And it again, you know, suggests that you're talking about an amount of ammo that you just don't want to be anywhere near.
And unlike the original show, we wanted these Cylons to actually hit some human beings. That you know, they weren't terrible shots. That there was a death toll. There were consequences to this war. It wasn't just a video game. So, you know, there's a number of people that you might not have established as fully blown characters, but people you recognize who you see die over the course of the 4 hours.
Well, and Michael, unfortunately, was in the position of having to deal with a lot of the task of cutting visual effect shots without a lot of help. At this point, as Ron's mentioned, he was, we were both involved in post to the extent we could after the director's cut, but Ron was doing Carnival, and at this point I had been recruited back to the studio. I'd been a producer, which is why I was brought in to do this, but now I'd gone back to Universal, where David Kissinger had asked me to return, and Michael was sort of in an editing bay with a vat of effect shots going, okay, which one of these do I remove? And Ron and I sort of conveniently waiting for new cuts to see if we liked what Michael had come up with. So this was, it's a bit unorthodox, only in that in a TV pilot, the director is usually kicked out much sooner. In this case, we needed him, and he was fortunately more than able.
8 weeks turned into 6 months.
Yes, 8 weeks turned into 6 months.
Well, just, you know, coming in late in the game and watching the cuts and seeing what Michael and Danny would do in the editing room and play with the structure and play with the moments and extending here and giving emphasis there. I mean, it became this living thing, you know, and it was really just like, leave them alone. They're really making this movie work.
And Zoic came up with a system of pre-visualization where Gary and his team would create these stick figures and sort of geometric shapes to show us what the shot would look like, which allowed us to get involved directly at a level that has not been previously normal for sci-fi work. Normally, you put in a slug, so the effects house delivers you the shot, and you go, oh, that's not quite what I had in mind, but to redo it is going to cost $100,000 and take 2 weeks, so you know what, good enough. And it made a lot more work for Zoic, but it was much more gratifying to me to get hands on and say, okay, well, if I were directing second unit in space,
yeah,
I would like that shot.
Now we have to give Gary Hustle credit for this line.
Yeah.
Gary
came up
with, didn't he write that?
Well, he
suggested calling it back, right?
I told Gary he had to come up with he didn't understand, or he didn't like, or there was some confusion about some aspect of how this finale was written, and he had a suggestion to simplify it and make it more exciting at the same time. And so I said, well, write out the beats, just write out physically what you want to see happen, and let me try to thread it into the script. And he came back with pages that actually had dialogue on them, which I think he needed just to sort of make his case. But one of the lines was this callback to jargon between Starbuck and Adama, where
bring in the cat.
Yeah, nothing but the rain, something bring in the cat, and Gary found a way to tie it into a literal battle reference of your canopy being rained down upon.
Yeah,
by
it
shrapnel.
Was a great. It was a true, like, you know, creative writer's idea.
Don't anybody let Gary listen to this. We don't want him to get too big ahead.
The hell with Gary. I mean, and then people would ask me, and then Gary asked me, so what does that? What do those lines mean when she's jogging around Galactic at the beginning, and he says, you know, what do you hear? Nothing but the rain. Well, then grab your gun and bring in the cat. Boom, 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 and off she goes. What does that mean? I said, well, it doesn't really mean anything. But it's sort of, the idea behind it was that in the military, there are these sort of jogging or marching cadences that are known as jodies, and you know, you've seen them in films.
They have the whole language.
It's a whole language of things. It's da 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 da
I just sort of made up, I sort of justified those lines as something that was part of some bizarre military case. What do you hear but nothing but the rain? I mean, it makes no sense. I have no idea what the song is supposed to be, but I thought it was kind of a cute and interesting reference. And then, but it pays off really well. I mean, it's great to see it actually pay off in the show.
Now, as we get into this scene, it bears noting that a couple hours before this was shot, I was called to Eddie's trailer. Eddie said...
this is the first day of his shot.
Yeah, and he said
he's
to me...
He's got to shoot his last scene first.
He was in with the actress who played Alosha, this woman here, and they both had the scripts, and they had their sleeves rolled up, and they looked like they had been at work, and I thought, oh, no. And I walked in there and I sat down and I found myself immersed in this conversation about the nature of the clergy and its impact on politics and history. And, you know, Eddie's a formidable guy and she's no dummy either. And they've both done a lot of homework. And I found myself struggling to recall my bachelor's degree in political science going, okay, history of religion and politics. Because their conclusion was they wouldn't be in the same room together, or they wouldn't be sharing the same ideas, or that her introducing Adama was inappropriate, and it became this sort of intellectual duel for about 2 hours. And then when we got here on the set, roll take one, and then what was never in the script was what Eddie is doing right now.
So say we all.
And the reaction...
It's a little ad-libbed. And it comes from the idea that Eddie believed, I think correctly, that Adama would not have come to this funeral prepared to talk everybody into the belief in the planet Earth. And that it had to come out of something that was happening in the present, which was their despondency. That he, as a leader, realized that he had to rally the troops. And I was freaking out because in my own mind, I had imagined that Adama would be very sort of gruff and callous and military in the beginning, and that by the end of the show, his experiences losing and regaining his son and everything would have softened him, and that this speech was going to end up being a much more caring, sharing feeling to it. Hey, let's all band together. So the first day on the set, you know, Eddie had said, no, I'm quite happy to shoot my last scene first, because it'll tell me where to go. And he comes out firing. I mean, this is even a toned-down version of what he did. And it was riveting and powerful and undeniable. And then, of course, David's behind me saying, hey, do you think you could get them all to cheer at the end? And I'm going, no way. That's so tacky, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, the entire cast burst out into spontaneous cheers, unprovoked by me or anyone. So I was like, threw up my hands and went, well, that's the truth of it.
That's right.
And
this was such a good instinct on Eddie's part. I mean, but all
of this repeating, as he did at the beginning, he's about to do of So Say We All, which is his way of not only bookending the ideas, but relating the ideas to what Alosha is saying, which is what they were struggling with in his trailer, was, again, not only not in the script, but not rehearsed, not discussed. And Michael and I are at the monitor going, what the hell is he doing? And everybody's reaction was, some of which we're using, is what the hell is he doing? And it was really quite a stirring moment and effective. And it made you realize that unlike a lot of actors, Eddie really does think in grand terms, in story terms, and in sort of philosophical terms as he approaches this stuff, not just in terms of his dialogue as the actor.
I mean, when I wrote the scene, the scene as written was just nothing special. It's at the end of the show, and you had to accomplish certain things, and, you know, I wanted to do this idea that, again, harkens back to the original series, that the concept of the original show was that they're looking for this bright, shining planet known as Earth. You know, this was part of the mythology, and it was important to me to return Galactica to that notion, that would then drive the series that I hoped was going to be made. And this was the moment to do that, and I was in love with the idea that Adama would make it up as a way to give people hope. And that was my big idea in the scene. But the scene itself was written as simply Alosha gives her end of the prayer, and Adama goes up to the podium. I had written that there was a podium. And he goes up to the podium and just gives this long speech. And, you know, it's just a speech, and then everybody is kind of moved and by the end of it. But his instinct to turn it like this, and the So Say the All thing, it captures the emotions of the characters and the audience,
And it's just, it's a reason why you, if you have good actors and a good director, you know, as a writer, you have to step back at a certain stage and say, this is the script, this is the intention, go do it, and trust that they will find the truth of what it is and make it better. And that scene is much, much better in the final cut than it ever was on the page.
And traditionally would have been the end of the movie, and the nice thing about the script is that even though the scene was different as written, it was still a sort of, okay, you know, let's take a moment now and pat ourselves on the back and sort of feel good about who we are, followed by a scene that you expect to be a burying of the hatchet and the two adversaries coming together to say, let's put aside, let bygones be bygones and be friends. And instead it becomes a scene about, oh, wait a minute, I still hate your guts. Well, you know what, I hate your guts too.
Yeah.
You're left now with this, you know, you're back to where
it's
you were.
It's still not
where,
pulling any punches.
Yeah, it's unresolved. It's not perfect.
Now on. About yesterday, during the game. Well, maybe I was out of line, too.
Yeah, Starbuck is so derisive here. And, you know, you can see Michael's jaw twitching there. He's so uncomfortable trying to make up with her. I guess definitely
she's sick. Giving him nothing. She's just giving him nothing there.
And there's, of course, the whole sexual undertone between the young woman and the older man, which is nice to have, but nice to have it sublimated too.
I am offering you a clean slate here.
I'm not interested in a clean slate with you.
Michael, you know, I have to say, was also somebody who, Michael Hogan playing Ty, was also somebody who I don't pretend to have thought initially was a slam dunk. I remember we were on the fence between he and another actor. We were worried about whether a guy as gruff as Michael would exacerbate the idea that Commander Adama would keep a drunk on the ship. Do we want a happy drunk or maybe a drunk who was a little bit more fun so you would understand why Adama would keep him around? And just it really feels great to feel like you know, made the right decision because the guy so delivers that you know, you end up looking smart after the fact.
And then bring it back to Earth. We wanted to show again what it's like to live in a tin can in a void, breathing air conditioning. So any chance we get to, you know, so Adama's grabbing a bowl of noodles between.
Eddie almost wanted to eat noodles before he wanted to do anything else in the show. The first day he showed up, he said, Adama eats noodles. Okay.
Yeah. And messily.
And messily, yeah.
I love the fact that his whole cabin is a mess. I mean, you know, that he is this very, almost buttoned down, very straight-laced character outside of his own space. But in his room, it's like books everywhere, there's crap sitting on the desk, and he's slurping noodles, you know?
From a different century, too. I love the way Mary walks in and looks around and is like, oh, so this is where you live.
Yeah,
so loaded.
And the way she plays the scene is so great because she's not... She has
power over him. She didn't say you were lying.
Yeah, she does, but she's not accusatory. She wants to know, what are you up to? You know, her curiosity is working, too.
Because it's not enough to just live. You have to have something to live for. Let it be Earth.
I always like this idea, too. It seems like this came after a couple of passes, I don't remember, but the idea that in the original Galactica, like you were talking about earlier, you know, there is an Earth, they're looking for Earth, and this, you know, there's probably not an Earth, but people need something to distract them.
They need something to distract them and hope, and they're in these tin cans, and you got to hope to live for something. And that, yeah, he's this big heroic leader, but he knows people, you know, and he doesn't believe it, but he's going to do it, and it's a deal with the devil, and you know that someday it's going to come back and bite him on the ass.
And so you have two leaders who essentially make a political deal here, to conceal the truth from people.
In awareness of
it's complex and dark. And it's not obviously heroic.
And Eddie's change here coming up where I can't remember what the original line was, but it's now, I'll take it under advisement
I'll think about it
as opposed to you got a deal. Yeah, it's left more elliptical.
It preserves his cards. It's sort of an agreement, but you get the feeling like he could like kick it off the table any moment.
You'll be in charge of the fleet.
And then I just want to point out one bit of artwork that the art department did, which the great painting that's hung between them. If you get close to that, you'll actually see that actually represents the Cylon Wars, and that there's a featured Cylon in the foreground.
An old-fashioned Cylon.
An old-fashioned Cylon, yeah.
And I have dibs on that painting.
The
show is canceled
in
20
years.
Now here, this is harking back to this conversation I had with Ron much later. I had thought it was very subversive that at the end of the scene, Baltar should leave.
And she's still there.
She's still there. Subtle, but just this, whoa, how does that work?
Well, and interestingly, I was so unnerved by it when I saw it the first time that in a brief bit of the direction of episode two, our new director had the same thing happen. He walked out of frame and she was still there. And I went, no, you can't do that!
When I find out, oh, maybe she's actually just a delusion.
It totally works. It works in the moment, and it's, you know, sometimes you can get too, like...
No, it does work, because it's subliminal. You don't really notice that that's what's happening, you know. And this, of course, again, we're, you know...
Yeah.
Leaving it with a little bit of a darkness.
Throws it away. You just feel like, okay, well, so he solved his alcoholism.
And Richard has some fairly... gentle music, not what you'd expect on a battleship. You've got a flute going. Mm-hmm. He starts a little bit of an R&B groove going, which is not what you're used to seeing on a spaceship. As we sort of tie up everyone's stories and shows, you know, one of the things about making a doco-like show is not every moment can be incredibly dramatic and heightened. You've got to allow a bit of space for life goes on. I think you had a lot more material like that in the original draft, particularly up the front, that we just
Stuff became the hardest to fight to keep, because
this was a whole sequence.
It's not specific to plot. It's not specific to paying off anything dramatically. It's more of an emotional character idea that life goes on. And
not big hugs and learning, but gentle.
But when you're an hour long, it becomes difficult to
just
justify.
Billy talking to other women and Delilah going by and grinning about
exactly.
it. You know, that's
wait a minute, come back.
And this little bee with Callie.
Another ad lib here.
Yeah, nice to be small. And then this bottle is back. I love the fact that the bottle is back.
Well, and you don't see him drink. You just see
the move there.
I think here's one of our mistakes. The cigar's too big. We all sort of said it later. That cigar's too big. It looks.
It was a version of
my
wife. This was the final shot
totally
of the series.
Really?
Oh yeah.
Well, Katie. If anyone wanted to keep a big cigar, it'd be Katie.
Yeah,
she agreed to, and I think you'll see her with a slightly smaller cigar.
Father and son are still unresolved. And then this little beat, this tiny little beat. Somebody's helping him. Now, the intention in the script was that, because in the script you cut from one scene to the other, and it was the idea was that Baltar had left that note, that Baltar was leaving, you know, the 12 Cylon, there are only 12 Cylon models, for Adama to help him. But in the way this is cut, it's not clear who's helping him. And actually, now in series, that gives me more freedom to play with the idea of who's helping Commander Adama and why.
So this shot coming up was probably the most complex shot of the entire shoot, involving a device that's called a motion control machine, which basically is a robot with a camera on it that will repeat the same move over and over and allow you to do multiple passes, so that then the visual effects guys put it together and we can show multiple versions of number six.
So the multiple passes are comped together so that different images can be included at the same time.
But really hard for the actors to figure out. They had no idea what the hell was going on as we were shooting, because, of course, it was, you know,
and they've got
an hour in driver time and we're all desperately rushing.
And there's this very loud, obnoxious noise going as they're trying to act.
There are two ideas in this that are very late in the process. The idea that's coming up, the final reveal of the final Cylon, that it's Sharon, was actually something that David came up with after the first draft or the second draft or something.
Yeah, it was another shower idea.
The whole script had been written and her entire storyline had been told, and he said, what if Sharon's a Cylon at the very end? and I loved it. And it worked.
Laura was going to be the Cylon?
No, that's
another myth being perpetuated.
That's a myth.
Okay.
But that all came up at the very end.
Thus Sprock, Battlestar Galactica.
And in some ways, you know, that it works because the whole storyline is not designed to right. do that with her.
Well, I had people, like I did my own little test screenings while we were cutting, convinced that it was Laura. Because why else would she say, no, we can't leave these people?
It has to be Laura.
She's doing such a bad job. She must be undermining this. Can't be any other reason.
And the final line of the entire movie, by your command, is a callback to the original series, but it was actually suggested by a friend of mine, Breen Fraser, who was a writer on Roswell, who I had read a draft of the script before the show came out, because it was getting such bad internet. It was getting slammed on the internet so much, and I slipped a copy to Breen and asked him to like read it and, you know, just give it an honest review and post it someplace, and he put it on Ain't It Cool News and like read it and put it on, and but he somewhere in there said, and how could you have Battlestar Galactica not have By Your Command? So that's how it ended up in the post.
Nice job.
Well, thank you all.